House Education Committee will come to order. Today is Tuesday, September 21st, and this is our September Education Days meeting. We have a lot of people in the room. We've got a good and varied agenda today, people from different parts of the state to talk about opportunities, challenges, and some exciting things that are going on. We have a lot of new people in the hearing room that haven't been here before. Some people that have been here before, they're now in new roles. And I just wanted to start with the committee having an opportunity to briefly say who you are and where you're from for the benefit of those that are joining us today. And Representative Van Orman, would you like to start?
Oh, thank you. Sorry. Representative Suzanne Van Orman, House District 52, Hood River County, 15 precincts in Clackamas County, and 2 in Multnomah County.
And I'm Chris Harker. I'm from House District 34, which is Beaverton and unincorporated Washington County.
Ron Maurer from Grants Pass, serving most of Josephine County.
Arnie Roblin from House District 9, down from Coos Bay up to Florence on the Oregon coast.
I'm Sherry Springer, State Representative for House District 17. I have 11 little cities. My crown jewel is Sayo, along with the other 10.
Nice catch. Cheyenne.
I'm Cheyenne Ross. I staff the committee.
I'm Michael Dembrough. I represent House District 45. That's Northeast Portland, out to Park Rose, the heights of Rocky Butte, to the city within a city of Maywood Park.
I represent Newburg, St. Paul, and Newburg. And my name is Kim Thatcher.
Betty Kopp, State Rep for House District 22, Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and North Salem.
Do we still have time for me to...
I don't know.
Make it short.
John Huffman, District 59, live in the Dalles. I represent 13,000 square miles of eastern Oregon, roughly 60 communities. All are part of 9 counties, Wasco, Sherman, Gillum, Wheeler, Grant, Jefferson, parts of Deschutes, Clackamas, and Marion counties.
And I'm Sarah Gelser, and I serve Corvallis and Philomath, which is District 16, entirely in Benton County, with the exception of 2 constituents who live over the river in Linn County. So our agenda today is a little different than it was originally published, so I just want to kind of talk you through the order that we're going and give you approximate times. So if you want to grab a cup of coffee, you can know where you're at. We're going to have a very brief report on the virtual schools. Basically, we're just going to acknowledge that report, have time to read it. That's obviously an issue that we have a lot of work to do, and we will be addressing that more in our December hearing and in the months up to that. Then by about 1:50, we will get to the early Head Start programs and how the new funds allocated earlier this year were used. Then we're going to have a little bit of a presentation starting approximately 2:15 about the Sun Community School in the Reynolds School District and some of the exciting things they're doing for kids there that have been boosting outcomes for kids. Similarly, from 2:40 till about 3 o'clock, we're going to have an update on the Gladstone Center for Children and Families and some unique and innovative things that they are doing there. We'll spend from 3 until about 3:45 talking about some things that are happening in the southern part of our state with South Medford High School and the Southern Oregon ESD. And then from 3:45 until about 4:15, we're going to talk about where the burden of proof lays in special education disputes. And the last item on the agenda is member ideas for committee bills. As you know, our House bill drafting deadline is this coming Monday, so any requests we want to put in as a committee, we need to talk about here. Otherwise, you can all still do your own individual bills. And the goal is to, for the first time ever, with this committee that always has full agendas, is to release us all before the time they kick us out of the room at 5 o'clock. So we may be done by 4:30. And to the degree we can help each other keep the agenda moving along, that would be great. So I would first invite, I'll open an informational hearing on the State Board of Education report on virtual schools. And you have all been here many times before, but I know we have a whole host of people that are testifying today that haven't, and I know you'll demonstrate that when you start, you introduce yourself for the record. And also, because I forgot to mention, if you have a cell phone or a pager, you need to turn it all the way off. not just to vibrate. And that is because people in other parts of the state may be listening to this on the internet or viewing it online, and it creates some problems with the audio. And we want people who are interested in these things to be able to hear what you've had to say. So thank you for turning your cell phones off. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser and members of the House Education Committee. For the record, I'm Jan McComb, and I staff the State Board of Education. And with me is Duncan Wise, one of the board members and our former chair, who worked so hard on this online topic. As you may recall, the board's been dealing with the online school topics for about 3 years. So I'm going to speak for about 90 seconds and then turn it over to my betters. Earlier this year, the legislature enacted House Bill 3660, and that bill directed the state board to do three things by September 1. Develop a proposed governance model for virtual schools, review appropriate levels and methods of funding for such schools, and identify which virtual schools enrolled students with disabilities and how many students with disabilities attended those schools. So the board discussed the online learning topic at every subsequent board meeting through August, and added a special board meeting for August 30th, and also formed a work group of stakeholders who met twice. The final report was delivered to the legislature on August 31st. So I will talk about the special education findings, and then Director Wise will talk about governance and funding. So on special education, most of the online schools do enroll special education students, but in lower numbers than in traditional schools. On average, about 5% of an online school's enrollment have special education status, and in traditional schools, that number is more about 11%, so about half as many. However, there were some subcategories in which the online schools reported higher numbers, and that was in the area of autism, emotional disturbance, specific learning disability, and other health impairment. The board recommends that the Department of Education monitor participation rates of special education populations in the online learning environment, and if necessary, develop policies to enhance access to such programs by all groups. Director Wise, you want to take over?
Great. Thank you, Jan. Members of the committee, my name is Duncan Wise, member of the State Board of Education. I want to thank you for inviting us to give a brief report, and I will try to be very brief. And what I would really like to do is continue the relationship we have. I've talked with a lot of you over the last several years on this topic. Vice Chair Dembro was actually an advisor to the board, and I think we'll agree that we've been at this a long time. He was helping us at the very beginning as we put some of the early policy on this very important and challenging topic of virtual online learning. And so I will just very briefly give a summary of the report, what we did, and then, again, if you'd like to, I'm happy to take questions now, but what I really would like to do, Chair Gelser, is just know that we're available as you develop legislation and continue to work on this. We're really eager to share our thinking and support you any way that you would like. So just to step back, as Jan mentioned, we've had a number of reports on this, and I go back to a 2009 report which we prepared. And the most fundamental point that I think that report said, and it was a very important statement at the time, is that the board believes the computer-based instruction can and should become an integral part of our education in Oregon in the coming years. In particular, we're looking at virtual full-time learning, said that for many students, or for a large number of students in Oregon, that this could be an important option to have available. And so we concluded that this was something that was here, that we needed to develop and create a new governance model for. This form of instruction, by its very nature, is a challenging one in the existing governance structure, as you all well know, because the schools themselves provide services outside the district where the student lives. And basically, a student in one part of the state is taking instruction with teachers and faculty in another part of the state, and that has created a challenge for how to govern and deal with this issue. And so we've struggled with this, you've struggled with this, we've had a lot of conversations about this, and what I will tell you is our board came to a unanimous decision at the end of August, so ready for your deadline, and we don't all share identical views on this. We struggled with it, and I think we've come up with a proposal that is very workable, that balances a lot of interests here, and that's coherent. I think we'll serve the needs of students, and as we move forward. We did have some broad principles that we were working with as we did our work around quality. We believe that any virtual program must be of high quality. We thought it was important that there be accountability among the providers. There should be a choice among providers available to students and their parents. There needs to be accountability, oversight. This cannot be this can't just be a pure free market without some significant state oversight for the state dollars involved. We saw the opportunity to increase efficiencies and lower costs of education and provide individual learning and equitable access to the populations. So broadly, what did we what are we recommending that we do on governance, enrollment, and funding? Those are the three big categories we were struggling with. On governance, we believe that nonprofits and charter schools that are chartered by or adopted by a district or an ESD should have the opportunity to provide these services, but they should have approval by the State Board of Education if they want to provide those services to students outside the home district. In other words, because this is of statewide significance and we need to have statewide accountability for the state dollars involved, that was very important that those schools be approved by the State Board of Education. And in terms of the students who could enroll in those schools, we felt up to 3% of students in any district should have the opportunity to choose those schools, assuming they do connect with the district and sign off in the sense of having a conversation with the home district and for discussion of the students' needs, understanding that those students often do come back to the district school and that we need to have a conversation with the home district involved. We recommended that the state have the authority to raise that limit from 3% to 5%, but giving adequate notice. We felt that gives adequate protection to the school districts involved in terms of the students attending those schools. In terms of funding, we start at a 90% of ADMW, that the student would be, for each student enrolled, 90% would go to the online school, with the remaining 10% dollars ADMW split equally between the home district and the sending district. And again, as a starting point on the funding model. And we also encouraged all districts to provide these options to their students beyond these requirements. We think it's a valid form of education available, and we encourage districts to negotiate with providers and develop their own programs to provide full-time services. So that, in a nutshell, is what we're recommending. I would stress, I think we talked earlier, that we understand online learning is more than full-time by far. In the long run, I think the individual classes and the kind of mixed virtual learning is going to be extremely important. This report doesn't deal with that. That's another topic. You might want to challenge us to go to work on that at some point. But there are other ideas out there you've probably been hearing. And again, we think there are a lot of other very promising opportunities on virtual learning. But this one particularly is focusing on the issue of full-time learning. And we think we've got a framework that can serve Oregon well. And again, we would love to work with you as we flesh this out. I would stress we had a deadline. We did the best we could within the deadline. We don't necessarily have every dot and T, and again, we'd be happy to continue to work on this if you would like us to do so. Thank you, Chair.
And will you be the appropriate contact as members have direct questions about the recommendation?
I'm happy to do it. Jan is probably the best. Jan, I want to stress, has done a fabulous job on this throughout in framing this. And so, again, Jan, and she's really become very knowledgeable. I'm obviously very happy to talk with you. I think any of the board members would be more than pleased to talk with you on this and their perspectives. Again, I think we've come to a consensus. We have nuances of difference, but I think what we really try to do is come up with a package that we all could support and think that will work well for Oregon.
Great, thank you. And I would invite any questions you all have, just basic to this report. I think for those of us that have spent a lot of time on this issue, it seems that the specific words on the page in the statutory proposal are very significant, and it will therefore be more helpful to have those words on the page to engage in real discussion, robust discussion about the specifics, and we will be devoting substantial time on our December agenda to that, and have some legislative councils, legislative drafts back that we'll be able to vet with one another. Representative Comp.
But thank you for reading my mind, but Chair Gelser, so just for a clarification, that these recommendations will come back to us as legislative proposals for action then?
Representative Comp, there will be a legislative draft that comes back that is influenced by the recommendations of the State Board of Ed. There may be multiple proposals that come back before the group, and I think as you're reading it, as you're asking questions of other stakeholders, kind of coming back as we refine those different proposals and concepts we might have before us in December, the overall goal is we've been wrestling with this issue for a long time. The families in particular in this circumstance really need to know what our resolution is on this issue so they don't need to continue taking time away from their families to watch the legislature. And so the amount of time we can put into it, each of us individually moving up to December and a really high-quality conversation in December should help us be ready to move forward with some proposals very early in the session when we reconvene.
Just to follow up on that, so your thinking is that this will come in the form of a committee bill or a series of committee bills that we'll be talking about in December?
Representative Dimbro, that is correct, that we would have concepts that would be starting points that we could introduce as a committee bill. I think the one piece that's very clear is the need to separate the charter statute from the virtual school statute. So that would probably be one of the concepts, and then some of these other governance would be in alternate concepts. Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we going to be receiving automatically copies of this report? If not, I'd like to put in a request for one.
Thank you. I had assumed that the department had sent them to all members of the Education Committee.
I believe so.
Thanks.
But we
we didn't bring hard copies in respect for
trying to be green.
I'm
happy to send electronically a copy of the report to every board member today.
Or just the link.
It's also available on our board page right now if you go to the August 30th meeting materials, mm-hmm. and we're looking to kind of highlight it on our front page a little bit more.
Okay.
And that would, following up on that, if you could send us a link through Cheyenne, sometimes it's hard to find links on the Department of Ed website, so to the degree that we can make it easy for people, not just on this panel, but in the audience who are very interested to access that, it would be very helpful.
It made that point.
Are there other comments or questions? No. Great, thank you. And Representative Springer and I have been having some discussions. I would invite all of you to engage in discussion with each other, with stakeholders, and if you're working on things in this area, if you could let me know so we can be as organized as possible for December and a well-structured conversation, I'd really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So I'll close the informational hearing on the State Board of Ed report on virtual schools and open an informational hearing on early Head Start programs and the use of new state funds. And I would invite up Dale Helland, Darcy Kilstunk, Farzana Siddiqui, and Karen Mooney. Was Nancy Johnson on our list? And Nancy, did you want to come up first, last? What's your preference? I'm not sure how you've organized your panel. Why don't you come to do questions at the end? That would be great. So welcome this afternoon. Colleagues, this issue came primarily out of the Ways and Means Committee, where there were some additional funds that were allocated during our February session to address some needs in early Head Start programs. And some of our colleagues on the Ways and Means Committee had asked that we hold a hearing this afternoon to find out about how those funds had been spent and allocated and some of the outcomes from those. Thank you. And I know there are a lot of you, and so when you're speaking, just make sure you're in front of a microphone, and if you can introduce yourself before you speak, and if there's a break, introduce yourself again so those that are listening far away will know who's speaking, please. Welcome.
Hello, I'm Darcy Kilsdonk, and I represent Umatilla Morrow Head Start. We serve seven counties in eastern Oregon, Umatilla, Morrow, Wallowa, Grant, Gilliam, Sherman, and Wheeler counties. We were the recipients of three slots, state-funded early Head Start slots, and I guess I'm here today to share with you kind of what we did with them. So right now we have 75 federally funded early Head Start slots, and for the most part, those go to serve teen parents in the counties that we serve. Pregnant and parenting teens, and we reserve those for teens who are either going to school full-time or working full-time. So there's a gap in services for teens who are, for whatever reason, not currently going to school. We have such a shortage of them that we have to prioritize that way. I'm here to share a story with you about a teen who has really had some difficulties and for a multitude of reasons has not been in school. She's had some juvenile intervention and has been involved with child welfare with her baby. When we recruited her, we weren't able to put her in a slot because she wasn't going to school full time. Because we place based on highest risk, when we got the three slots, we decided to create home-based slots and allow students who may not necessarily be going to school to fulfill those slots with the goal of pushing them towards school. This girl's and her child really rose to the top as far as priority. Lots of issues with attachment and bonding. The child was very difficult to soothe. We went ahead and enrolled her in our home-based program, and they get services weekly from a home visitor who works with both her and her mother, the grandmother of the child, on cognitive development, appropriate attachment, mental health issues for both the teen and the baby. And I'm happy to say that that teen has enrolled in school. So we really feel like that's been a successful intervention and really exciting for her and her child. And we're hopeful that that intervention will then result in that child being successful in school. So that's my story that I wanted to share. It's a very heartwarming story and very exciting.
Thank you. I would like to thank the committee for giving us the opportunity to come and share the experiences we had with the funding we received. I'm Farzana Siddiqui, and I'm representing Community Action Head Start of Washington County, and we serve children, about 798 children, 111 are early Head Start children. We serve children in early Head Start in three program options, and home-based option is a very successful program option, serving families in Beaverton and Hillsboro areas. We were funded for seven slots, and of those seven children, four were from Beaverton and three from Hillsboro, and three children were referred by Department of Human Services. One was eligible for early intervention services, and one child was homeless. So I have two stories that I would like to share. One family was homeless for 4 months prior to enrolling in our program and had just transitioned from a shelter into their own apartment. The home visitor began connecting them to services in their area, and the family was eligible for food assistance through WIC program. Screenings revealed that the child had possible speech language issues. So the home visitor focused on activities that enrich speech and language. And the mother recently reported that her son's language is developing very well. Then the second family comes from the refugee families from Somalia. And in Beaverton, we have a big population of Somali refugee families. So this child comes from a family of refugees from Somalia. He came to our program through a referral from the Morrison Center. The staff identified that this family was high risk. They have 6 children, including a girl who was in our program several years ago and was identified by our home-based program to have autism. And because we identified her as needing early intervention services, she received the evaluation, diagnosis of autism, and is now receiving services and just started public school. So this little boy in the same family is now in our home-based program. And this boy has been identified as having a possible speech and language delay. He and his entire family are learning English during home visits and socialization, and this family has been very involved in the program. And they're very active participants in socializations and parent center meetings and are benefiting from the program. So without this funding that we received for 7 children, we would not have been able to serve these families and children and the benefit that they are receiving. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dale Helland, and I am the Head Start Director for Coos and Curry Counties. We received funding for 4 early Head Start children, joined with the 52 that we got from the federal government. This program is probably the most important program that any state, any person in education can get involved in. As a psychologist, I know that the development of children's brains has already gone through significant growth by the time they reach 3 years of age when they can enter Head Start. Being able to do the comprehensive services that we are able to do in early Head Start is an investment in our future and our children's future that cannot be overvalued. I will tell you about one child. Amy was 21, child to me, when and homeless, living in a car with her 2-month-old daughter when she got an application for our program, attracted by the sign that said free daycare. We enrolled the child in our program, connected Amy with housing help, WIC, and at the present time, Amy has a home that she shares with her daughter. And because her daughter is in full-day early Head Start program with us, safe and secure, she's able to get involved in the jobs program and is working towards becoming self-sufficient. That's the kind of thing that can happen. It's not typical of every child, of course, but it is more likely to happen there than in probably any other program in the state. I wanted to thank the committee, those of you that may have been involved with the decisions that got the funding originally. Oregon has got to be proud of being at the forefront of funding these programs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Karen Mooney, and I'm the Family Services Manager with Mid-Columbia Children's Council. And we serve children in 3 counties in Oregon, Hood River, Wasco, and Jefferson. We received funding for 5 children and families, and we've placed that funding to serve children in Jefferson County. Jefferson County, of course, all of Oregon has been hit by the economy, but Jefferson County is the county with the highest unemployment rate in Oregon and has been severely hit by the recession. We are experiencing that with those 5 children and families, noting the number of the extreme need of all of those children that we have funded there. We chose to do a home-based funding. We also had some expansion from Head Start and married that funding so we would be able to fund a full-time person to work with early Head Start. With our home-based program, we're working very hard to support families that have many social issues that are causing them to have a struggle to be able to be good parents. And so we support them in how do you become a good parent and the best teacher for your child, even through the struggles that you have, and how can you continue to be developmentally appropriate, warm and nurturing, and responsive with your children. We have, I'm going to touch on a couple of success stories. We have had a family that was had moved to Jefferson County and was homeless. Currently, that family now, with their small child, have an apartment to live in, and they also, the father has gotten a job with Burger King, and so they now have income. Additionally, we have been working with some family that has, the mother has a mental health issue and has been recently working with not only ourselves but with the relief nursery in Jefferson County, and now has returned to taking her medication. So that was another family that we've had success with. The support that Early Head Start provides to the parents is a wonderful avenue to be able to get the needs met for your for the children at that age, when the relationship with their parent is the most important and critical way to get their development started off to a good start. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, before we move on to Ms. Johnson-Dorn, are there questions for the... Those were great presentations, and it's always good to hear the specific stories about successes. Are there questions before we move to the next? Representative Thatcher.
Can I just get a clarification? I hear things like home-based funding. Can I get a definition of those different modes of funding, these slots that you're talking about?
Home-based is a type of services where there's a one home visit weekly and then two group socializations. The one home visit weekly is 90 minutes, provides support for the parent and child development. And then the socialization is twice a month or every 2 weeks, and that provides opportunity to break the isolation for the families and also further additional support with the parents as they interact with their children in that arena.
Preschool only or pre...
This is Early Head
Start. Early Head Start.
This particular one is Early Head Start. It could be done with preschool, but we're talking about Early Head Start funding. I think we also had mentioned full day care, which would be child care starting early in the morning and going through the afternoon for working families.
And so I think it might be helpful to clarify, not everyone in the room is familiar with the definition of Early Head Start. Could you describe that age range and population?
Early Head Start works with families that are from pregnant women through three.
Thank you.
And these are different program options. So when you create the Early Head Start program, you can do one of several different options, and home-based is one option you can provide, or full day, or there's also some part-day combinations where you have more home visiting and less classroom time, or more classroom time and a little bit less home visiting. So it's just the option.
Representative Dimbro.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So these programs really lend themselves well, I'm sure, to partnering with other organizations, I mean, schools, ESDs, counties, et cetera. Could you give us some examples of some of the partnerships that are happening, you know, co-efforts, co-locations, things like that?
We currently have a very good partnership with Department of Corrections in Wilsonville, where we serve the children of incarcerated mothers in our Early Head Start program, where the children are taken care of by the caregivers, and the moms from the prison come into the classroom, and that's the time they can meet their children, and there's bonding and relationship building happening. So that's a example of partnership with the Department of Corrections. And we have partnerships with school districts also. Sometimes we get facility through the school districts, and or like, you know, local faith-based communities, they may provide room for socialization to us, and transportation support also.
Representative Van Arman.
Well, I suppose I ought to expose myself as the former executive director of Mid-Columbia Children's Council.
Legal?
What, exposing myself? On this podium, I am sure it is legal. And that I am responsible for the Early Head Start program in Mid-Columbia Children's Council. in terms of the program, I think it's important to point out that the state of Oregon has aligned itself with the federal performance standards. So the federal performance standards pretty much outline what Head Start is going to look like, early Head Start and Head Start. 1,750 performance standards. And so programs do have options of what kind of services they're going to provide. And that's based on what the community looks like and what's the capacity of the community. So one of the questions that I actually do have a question.
Right.
If I may, thank you.
Of course.
In looking at the funding, we have a wide variety, and I'm looking at it as cost per child, our familiar term. And we range from, I think, Mid-Columbia being probably the lowest through an accounting error on the federal part, $9,600 for a year, and then some as much as $14,000. So my assumption is that the Department of Ed chose, when you broke up the money, you matched that dollar per child by program. Is that correct?
And this might be a good point to transition. Do you want to come over to the table? Would anybody be willing to swap spots with her? So Representative Van Orme, I'm going to let Nancy Johnson-Doran introduce herself.
That's quite all right.
And as we move into the more technical questions here.
That's great.
Thank you very much for your flexibility in musical chairs.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nancy Johnson-Dorn, and I'm Director of Early Childhood Programs at Oregon Department of Education. And I think that you have a handout.
Did you?
About the three-page handout? Okay. If you look at the front page of that handout, we lay out the steps. You know, first you'll see in the upper part of that the budget note to House Bill 5100, and that's just there for your reference. And then there are the steps that we went through in determining how to allocate these funds. And we followed the budget note. Part of that was looking at the federal funds and, yes, matching those funds with the state funds to add additional children. We negotiated with each program the number of children that they'd be able to take. One program declined our offer. We offered two slots, and they could only make it work with four, and so they said no thank you. And we went back to the rest of our federally funded programs and redistributed funds again. We were directed by, through the House bill, to fund slots in existing federally funded early Head Start programs. So we had to take an inventory to find out which programs already had slots. Some just had newly funded slots from the feds, and they were not yet, the slots weren't filled yet as of March 1st. So those programs didn't get any of these slots. The second page shows a breakdown of the programs the county served, the number of state funded slots each program got, and a number of the federally funded slots and the total. And then you can see the state funding in the right-hand column. And that was based on the 15 months starting, I think it was April 1st, as far as 15 months. We also had a reduction during that time and reduced some monies to some programs, and also you have a footnote that's missing on your copy, I think, but there was five slots that were reduced in one program because that program had not yet had children placed in those slots. So that seemed to be the best thing to do was, instead of removing kids from slots, was to take a program that hadn't even put children in yet and reduce in that way. I think the last page shows some differences between Head Start being the 3-5 program and Early Head Start being the birth to age 3 program.
Thank you. Does that get to your question, Representative Van Orme?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there further questions? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, Nancy, how does OPK fit into all this?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, no, OPK does fit in with this. Right now or this next session, we want to take the statutes that
speak to OPK and extend that range to be birth or 0 to age 5 to incorporate this program. So if we are so lucky to continue to get funding for this program, we would meld those together into to one big birth to 5 program.
Follow up, ma'am.
Thank you. Follow up.
So is OPK is a state only program. Head Start and Early Head Start is a blend of state and federal. Is
when we talk about Federal Head Start includes Early Head Start. Okay? And when we speak of Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program, those are the state funds that pay for the 3 to 5-year-old program that follows the Federal Head Start standards.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any further questions? Great. Thank you all very much. It's impressive to see how quickly you've been able to put those dollars to work and really start to make a difference for some pretty vulnerable kids in the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And colleague Jill, notice on the handout from Nancy Johnson-Doran, the reason we're having this hearing is we were directed to do so by this budget footnote, and I'm sure Representative Comp's committee over at Ways and Means will be following up further on this issue as we're making the hard decisions about next biennium.
We are studying every facet of it, of the budget. So, yes, thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. So I will close the informational hearing on Early Head Start programs, use of funds, and open an information hearing on the Sun Community School in the Reynolds School District. Welcome. So I would invite up Peggy Simolinski, Brooke Tuvison, and Leanne Cox. Welcome. And just as by way of introduction of this agenda item, we have tackled some pretty difficult things in this committee, and one of my commitments to you was to work on finding some uplifting points to talk about from across the state. There were many, many choices, and this program was recommended by a couple of different sources as a point of sunshine, pardon the pun, and they're here to talk to us about some innovative ways that they're supporting kids and families and really boosting student learning and achievement. So welcome.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Peggy Samolinski, and I am with Multnomah County, the Department of County Human Services, and I have the privilege of being a division manager within that department for Multnomah County. We appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon, to share with you some information about the Sun Community School Initiative in Multnomah County, and in particular, what's happening at Alder Elementary School in the Reynolds School District. I am joined today by two esteemed colleagues, Brooke Tuvison, who is a supervisor with Metropolitan Family Service, one of our nonprofit contractors, and Leanne Cox, who's a school counselor at Alder Elementary School. So I think we're going to do the presentation. I'm going to give an overview of Sun Community Schools, what it is, what it means in Multnomah County, and how it works generally. And I think what you'll hear from my colleagues is how they take what I say and the words I give you into action and what really happens at a school when the school is a Sun Community School. So we appreciate this opportunity to be able to share this with you. So we start out by telling folks that SUN stands for Schools Uniting Neighborhoods, and that was a very intentional name. At the time when the initiative began in the late 90s, the adults and bureaucrats around the table could not come up with a name. And they had names that had 10 or 12 words in them, and none of them were very adequate, and they went to a group of kids who they mulled around the idea and said, let's come up with SUN, and it stands for Schools Uniting Neighborhoods. And that is a perfect and very apt representation of the initiative, because at its core, a community school really is about building partnerships and a sense of community within the school building and in the surrounding neighborhood. In Multnomah County, Sun Community Schools is really a critical strategy in our community to both ensure school success and reduce poverty by aligning social and support services in a neighborhood school so families have access to services in one location. In fact, Sun Community Schools in particular are a core cornerstone program in our broader Sun service delivery system that we have in the county. And that system brings an array of social services such as early childhood, youth case management, and anti-poverty services, as well as what happens in a Sun Community School. We like to say that SUN brokers social support services so that teachers can teach, principals can be leaders in their building, and social work can happen by social workers. And we know that's not always so simple, but that is the aim of what we're trying to build there. As I mentioned briefly, the initiative began in 1998 in Multnomah County, and it really was a conversation between then-Chair Beverly Stein and City Commissioner Jim Francesconi, who were looking for a way to really operationalize community building. They didn't know, they knew what it meant, but we didn't really know what it looked like or what it could look like. So they charged a group of folks to go and do some research, and they came back with this notion of creating opportunities in a school building to become a hub and a center in that community. And that's resulted in the Sun Community Schools. We started in 1999 with 8 sites. It was bold. They were mostly important public schools, but in different places around the community. And we've grown since then. To this year, we have 60 Sun Community Schools spread across Multnomah County in 6 different school districts within our region. And I see many of you have looked through the packet, and there's a map in there, one of the handouts, and that, thank you very much. And that depicts how they are geographically located throughout Multnomah County. We've been working really hard in the last couple of years to have some, what we call geographic equity, knowing that poverty and people are moving east, both moving east and moving into east, and we know that there's a high need for these social and support services in that particular region. In Multnomah County, we have a vision that every school become a community school. And while that's really bold and some people get stuck at the dollar sign when we talk about that, it is something that we're working on across our community with leaders and other folks who are invested in this effort. Nationally, our model has gained some attention and recognition for a variety of reasons. One is because of the strong local government we have involved. Because of the inception with the city and county so invested early on, we've maintained that investment over the years, both in resources as well as staff time and leadership commitment and champions for the effort. So we have a really strong multi-jurisdictional partnerships. We have deep level of collaboration with the school districts and the school buildings. We share resources. The funds really are a blended pot of funds that support the Sun Community Schools. And we really have, we've aligned services around this vision for every school, community school, that striving toward improving academic success and reducing poverty. Multnomah County is often the face of Sun, and yet we see ourselves as what we call the managing partner. And by that means that we let the contracts with the nonprofits. We provide program development assistance, training, technical assistance. We do data collection, reporting, evaluation, and we convene our partners on a regular basis for program efforts, for planning conversations, and we staff the Sun Service System Coordinating Council, which is a broad array of leaders who provide oversight and governance for the bigger system. As I mentioned just a minute ago, the funding for the sites really is a blend. Of the 60 sites, we have funding from county general funds, the city general funds, Portland Children's Levy, 21st Century grant funds, as well as some school district dollars. And that's in addition to the match that the nonprofits have to bring to the table. So we've really blended dollars over the years, which further cements our partnership together. We speak about community schools not as a program per se, but as a strategy or as an approach, again, a way to try to bring partners together in a school building to support kids and families. As I mentioned earlier, at its core, it is about creating partnerships and relationships in a school building, both for the kids in that school and the surrounding community. We like to talk about it as collaboration, not just co-location. It's important that people in a school building know who each other are, know why they're there, know what they're striving to accomplish, and that they work together to do that, and Sun brings that umbrella to any given school building. In our model, we have a Sun site manager, a Sun site coordinator, which is a person in that building who wears many, 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 many hats. On any given day, there might be a dozen atop that head, and you'll probably hear about some of that today. They're often called a gatekeeper, the assistant vice principal, the principal after school, or a broker, given the many roles that they play with both developing the extended day activities, the activities, both recreation, academic, and enrichment that happen after school or sometimes before school, the outreach to and engage with families in that school building, they broker and provide health services or social support services, connect families to the resources that they need, and they build partnerships with the local businesses around that school building to support the kids and families who attend that school. But they don't do it alone. They do it in tandem and right alongside the principal. What we know is that it's most successful in buildings where the principal is fully engaged in providing the leadership for the Sun effort to be successful, and the Sun site manager and that principal work together in every given day. And it's more about after, it's more than just after school. That's often the most visible. People hear about tutoring or homework club or dance club, or maybe there's basketball or sewing club, many, many, many enrichment activities that happen. But by working so closely in the school building, we are trying to blend what happens in the academic day with what happens after school. So if a given school in its school improvement plan perhaps is working on reading that year, they have that as a focus, but some activities will try to focus on that as well, whether that's through bringing in extra tutors to work with kids on reading. It might be setting up a book club, a spelling bee, any myriad of activities they'll offer to try to help support those activities and those academic pursuits in that given school building. And they are open to any school in the building. Given limited capacity, we do try to target students who may be at risk for academic failure. That's defined very broadly. It may be a student who, for whom English is not the native language, a student who is poor, a young person who's homeless or whose family is homeless, or any one of those characteristics. We reach out to them through the connections in the building with the principal, with the counselors, with the other staff in the building to connect with those kids, to connect with their families, to draw them into the after-school activities so that they can have the extra support they may need in order to be successful. Finally, I want to speak just a little bit to the success, and you have, in your packets, you have some handouts that speak to some of the outcomes that we're tracking. We collect a lot of data around what's happening in every given Sun Kamee school and all of our programs for that matter. And I want to just highlight a few of the big ones. And last year, for example, in 08-09, that's most recent year that we have all the data, over 14,000 kids were engaged in activities at Sun Kamee schools. There were 58 last year, so there were over 14,000 kids. Nearly 7,000 of them connected for more than 30 days. And that's a national standard that we use to measure level of involvement in the community school, a student who's been there for 30 days or more in a variety of activities. So those are the kids on whom we really track their outcomes. We look at academics, benchmarks, attendance. We have student surveys. We have teacher surveys. We do a lot of things to try to gauge how we think participating in the community school effort is in fact assisting kids to be better academically and stronger stronger students. So for students who did participate for over 30 days last year, 75% of them increased their benchmark scores in reading, 77% increased them in math, and those students had a 95% attendance rate, which, and those compared to the district's average of about, or the target of 92, and most of our district's average about 93. So we're, you know, a little bit ahead of the average in terms of attendance. In addition, the students you'll see on your sheet did show some growth in some of the things that are a little squishier to measure, like developmental assets, how they feel about themselves, how they feel about adults and the world around them. We ask students for some of that information as well, so we can be sure that we're touching on those areas as well in their lives. So finally, in closing, I'm just going to say that I think, as you know, we're in tough economic times, and we really believe that community schools make even more sense because they maximize resource, they capitalize on public assets, including buildings and facilities, and they create community-based places where children and families in a neighborhood know that they have a safe place that they can be. Next, I'm going to turn it over to Brooke Tuvison from Metropolitan Family Service, who's going to speak to some of the efforts that happen at Alder Elementary School. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Thanks for welcoming us to speak to you all today. And as Peggy said, I'm Brooke Tuvison. I'm a program manager at Metropolitan Family Service, and we're the lead agency nonprofit provider of Sun Community School Services in the Reynolds School District, as well as select other school districts. And want to share a little bit about the work that we're doing at Reynolds School District's Alder Elementary School. We've been providing Sun School Services there for 8 years now. So a little background on Alder, and you all within your packet on the right-hand sleeve have some information about outcomes and information that's specific to Alder Elementary's Sun School. Alder's one of Oregon's lowest socioeconomic standing schools. 92% of students qualify for free or reduced lunch. Last year, 92 students out of the 595 in the building fell within federal guidelines defining homelessness. So it's almost one in every six students in the building qualifying under federal guidelines as being homeless. 70% of the students in the building speak English as their second language. Over the past few years, Alder's really struggled to meet academic targets, and actually in the 2009-2010 school year, this was the first time in 4 years that the school met adequate yearly progress. So last year marked a huge turning point successfully for the school in terms of academics. Despite all of these school-wide struggles, our Sun Community School program is really seeing some positive outcomes.
Last year, we enrolled nearly 350 of Alder's 595 students in after-school classes, so serving more than half of the student body in after-school opportunities. In the 2008-2009 school year, of Alder youth who attended our enrolled programming for 30 days or more, 74% made gains in their Oregon State reading tests, and 83% made gains in their math tests. Really, when it comes down to it, our strategy for supporting youth is to recognize and support multiple factors that we know contribute to their educational success. So the first of these, and as Peggy shared, probably the most visible, is our after-school programming. So we enroll youth in a wide variety of after-school offerings. And this is really anything from traveling soccer teams, where they get an opportunity to go out and experience friendly competition with students at other schools for a first time. We're talking about elementary school youth, many of whom come from high-poverty backgrounds and don't have an opportunity to do that elsewhere. We have a gardening club where students learn the basics of plants and how they interact with earth and some of the life cycles there, and also even do a service learning project where they grow plant starts that they later give to community gardeners who use some space at Alder Elementary School to raise their own food. We've got embroidering classes that are taught in Spanish for our native Spanish speakers. And we also have intensive targeted math and reading support. One thing that we're really excited about is starting in spring of 2009 with Alder's really intense concerns about meeting adequate yearly progress. We came together with the building principal and really tightened our collaboration around academic support. And we developed a program within SUM that's called the Alder Academy. And with this academy, the principal's actually flexing some school day teachers' time so that rather than working a 7:30 to 3:30 schedule and leaving the building right at the end of the day, some of his staff are working from 8:30 to 4:30 every day and actually teaching targeted interventions for students in reading and in math and are in the building until our after-school program ends at 4:30. So in the second year of that new partnership, we've got 7 school day teachers who are actually there all the way through our after-school program. And Leanne can speak more to that when she talks, but she's got some real concrete examples of how that's working well for certain students. But the broader picture is that collectively this is really forming a menu of services for our kids where hopefully every single kid in the building is able to find something that they need. So for some kids, we know that that's really intensive academic support. For other kids, we know that that might just be a safe place to be after school or a place to gain some social skills or, you know, be able to talk a little bit more about positive behavior and how to behave better within the school setting. We work really closely within the school building to ensure that we're reaching the right kids, so the ones who really need it the most. We work with school counselors to identify kids who maybe have behavioral issues who could benefit from being there, who maybe are living in poverty or in foster care and need a safe, constructive place to be after school, and then, of course, with school day teachers to determine who needs the extra academic support. And then additionally, we're working with a lot of partners to make sure that we can get our services out to everybody and that we're being inclusive. So we've developed partnerships in the community and in large part with leadership from Multnomah County building some of these partnerships in collaboration with us. We've been able to access things like one-on-one aids. So if a particular student needs that level of inclusion in order to participate successfully after school, they're able to do that. Beyond what we're offering for students after school, we really recognize family members as key contributors to student success, and we offer enrolled class opportunities for adults. So these are open to the community at large as well as parents within the Alder community. They include things like English as a second language class, home motherization workshops, parenting classes, early childhood groups for parents and their younger students. And in addition to these enrolled opportunities, and last year we had 92 parents participate in classes where they register in advance and come on a regular basis, we're also realizing that for some adults, they're not going to show up for a regular class that happens once every week, or that might not be the right fit for them, but we want to make sure we engage them too. So we're offering family involvement opportunities where we bring parents, guardians, siblings into the school building to be able to celebrate the successes of their kids, see them perform the music that they've been working on in their son after school class, or see the artwork hanging up on the walls, and just have fun being within the space of the school building alongside their students and help them feel comfortable there. We also know that many Alder families are struggling to meet their basic needs, and we've established partnerships with social service agencies who provide assistance with needs such as rent assistance, energy assistance, food assistance. We help link families into those key services. We know that unless the students' basic needs are met, they're really going to struggle to learn well during the school day, and so we want to support them in that way wherever we can. And then finally, we recognize that the local community are contributors to school as well, and we know that community members and groups can bring skills and resources that strengthen Alder school community overall. So we develop a lot of partnerships out there in the community. So some examples of what we've got at Alder include a partnership with the Imago Dei Faith Community, and they adopt the school each year. They offer volunteer support within the building as well as resources to meet basic needs. 2 years ago, they gave every child in the building a backpack filled with school supplies. So 600 backpacks, that was a pretty incredible offering that they gave. Portland State University students offer free English as a second language classes to adults on site twice a week throughout the school year. The Oregon Health Career Center is another partner, and they offer after-school science clubs for youth at no cost to our program and no cost to the youth. And those are just three examples of, you know, the vast partnerships that we've got in the building. But probably the most important thing to note about the success that we've seen is that we can't do this alone, and it really takes the team of community members and our close collaboration with the school. So I want to turn things over to Leanne Cox, who's our partner and school counselor at Alder Elementary, so she can speak to some of the individual school success and student success that we're seeing.
Thank you. And I just want to give a break here. Do members have questions before we move on to the last presenter? Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wow, lots going on. With the population of students and families that you have there, I see that you've got a couple of Spanish book club type things, mm-hmm. and you've got a lot of ESL kids. Are there any projects going on where those native Spanish speakers or other native language speakers are teaching white kids who only speak English?
Yes,
or
actually.
Or some other kids who only speak English, another language?
One other thing that we've been really proud of in our program is that over the last few years, we've been able to engage a couple of community parents who really came on board more in volunteer capacities with the school or were working as lunch recess aides and got to know the SUN program really well and get to know us better. And we've gotten them some training and support in things like classroom management and in teaching certain topics. For example, one of our parents who teaches in SUN after school classes teaches the garden club. So we got her trained in gardening activities that you could do with youth. And so they're there on site every day after school helping teach our classes. And one of those parents is a Spanish speaker who doesn't speak very much English. And she's teaching embroidery class pretty much in Spanish. And because it's tactile, she's really able to demonstrate the kind of work and what to do. And last spring, we started plugging in some kids who aren't Spanish speakers, and they wound up really thriving in her class, actually. For the right kids, that was working really, really well. And, you know, you walk down the hallway, and you glance into her classroom, and the classroom management is perfect, and every kid's engaged. And it's just an amazing thing to see fourth-grade boys sitting there embroidering. And, you know, no, the kids who have severe behavioral challenges just doing amazingly well in her class. So that's been a great thing to see.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. One of the first question is, the Alder Elementary, is that located in the Rockwood area?
Yes.
Okay, so there's significant social problems in Rockwood, and do you have a role in working on those?
Yeah, absolutely. Our staff, myself included, participate in community meetings on a regular basis. So out in East Multnomah County, there's a group called the East County Caring Community that's existed for years and really meets around a lot of social service needs and just general community needs. And that's a monthly collaboration that lately has been primarily social service providers coming to the room, but also local city representatives or community members as well. So we're at that table regularly. There's also a group called the Rockwood Action Team. That's another really active group in East County, again, primarily social service providers, but some individual clients of ours as well that also meets on a monthly basis and just generally talks about the trends that we're seeing in the community, the resources that we've got, how we might partner to really be efficient in terms of serving the community. And then we also work on special projects, so things like throwing a Rockwood community-wide back-to-school fair on an annual basis where we can help get needed school supplies out to students.
Thank you. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, is some of your funding come through the Commission on Children and Families for your community schools?
Actually, we do not have funding through Commission for some community schools in particular. We have some funding from the Commission on Children and Families for our youth case management program, which is part of a bigger SUN system, but it's not some community schools in particular.
Thank you.
However, if I could add one more thing, please, Madam Chair, is
yes.
2 years ago, we did have some funding from the State Commission. We helped them develop the technical assistance for the statewide rollout of the community school effort they were involved in, and we were helping do that TA work.
I just want to say thank you.
Okay.
My wife's an elementary principal in Coos Bay, which is a community school that was funded through that and your help. And I thought there was a connection.
Yes,
so I was trying
you.
To figure
yes.
out where that connection was.
Very good. I'm glad you,
so thank you.
Glad you asked.
Thank you.
We're glad she likes it.
I think of Representative Dimbro and then Representative Thatcher.
Sure.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm following up on Representative Harker's question about language. I think we cannot overstate the importance of programs like this for families that are new to this country. And the opportunity that they provide for people who otherwise would have nothing to do with their schools, who would be, you know, who would feel that there's no place for them in their children's school to have entry in and to feel invited. May I say that because I visited a program at Rigler. Peggy brought me there. And there they have a before school program that's designed for Spanish-speaking women,
mm-hmm.
right, particularly.
Yes.
And it's a kind of support group that has really empowered this group of women, as far as I could tell, and can then, as a result of that, if their kids are having any problems, you know, with the school, they feel there's an avenue for them to attend. And I think that the more that we can be investing in that kind of thing, I think that the greater the payoff will be, not only for those children, but for those communities.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I'm wondering is, I remember you telling me this, but I can't remember, if the programs go to sleep completely during the summer, or do they continue during the summer? Or, you know, obviously there's an important role to play for these students, for these programs, for these students in the summer.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll answer that question. The SUN generally offers 4 to 5 weeks worth of programming in the summer. And historically what they've done is worked with school staff to really target the specific kids that could benefit from some extra summer help to keep them either moving in the right direction or headed stronger in the right direction, usually working with 40 to 50 kids over the course of the summer. However, this last summer, we were very, very fortunate. Our Board of County Commissioners were able to give us some one-time money to expand summer meals in the summer through Sun Community Schools and our partnership with Parks and Rec. So we served meals all summer long in some of the sites. So for some kids for whom summer hot meal through free noodles lunch is their only hot meal in the day in the summer, if they came during that 4 weeks, they were able to get it then. And this summer, many of them could come for the entire 11 weeks of the school year, of the summer, excuse me. So yes, they continue in the summer, and this summer we were able to go a little bit longer, particularly around meals, but we did. We offered some activity that was an incentive for folks to come.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Thatcher, and then we're going to let you wrap up because we're beyond our a lot of time on the agenda.
Thank you. I'm just wondering what role the state plays in all this. It sounds like it's very community-based, and it sounds like a great success story,
mm-hmm.
and we always like to hear about success, but I'm wondering what we might have to do.
What you could do, or what currently?
I'm yes,
excuse
currently.
Because I might have a few could put out.
What maybe you're looking for?
You know, we currently have a role with the State Commission. They're engaged in a statewide effort around community schools, and I know the funding has reduced in that area, but that still is a huge commitment of theirs because of what it does in a given school building and what it brings to a community. The notion of community school is still very alive and well. Certainly, the Department of Education has been supportive of this effort. They understand what we're doing. Susan Castillo has been to speak a few times with us, so I believe that Department of Ed is supportive. And then through their funneling of 21st Century dollars, which didn't happen this last spring, but the year before, that is another way that schools are able to create community schools using those 21st Century Learning funds as well.
And I would ask a follow-up question on that. As Alder School became a SUN school, what was that local teaching staff, administrative staff, parents, is this something they worked together to decide to do and put together for their...
I believe so, but...
I'll start that. Yeah, generally, yes. It's usually very homegrown. What happened with the 8 that we started in 98, then word got around, and everybody wanted to be a community school, and we haven't had the resources to make that happen. What we focused on really tightly in the last maybe 6 years is really trying to ensure that every really high-poverty school in the county is a Sun Community School, and they're not all yet. But Alder has always been in the top 5, I think, in terms of poverty level in the school. So as resources, whether they were children's levy funds or 21st century grant dollars, or just depending on the funding source, we've worked as a collaboration to identify the next schools and then secure the resources for that. So Alder and Reynolds were always at our table and always wanting to be a Sun Community School.
Great. Thank you. And if you would like to briefly summarize, I'm sorry that it's such an exciting topic and there's never enough time to talk about everything we'd like to.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I'll just give you some highlights of some successes we've seen at Alder. Brooke very eloquently described our after-school academy program, and a third grade teacher was sharing with me just yesterday that several of her students from last year showed incredible gains in their reading scores on the Oaks reading test, and these were students that had attended the...
And would you state your name for the record?
I am Leanne Cox.
Thank you. That's okay.
Counselor at Alder Elementary School.
Thank you.
So just to give you some examples, we know that a 7-point increase on the state test is a year's worth of growth, and this is in reading. And some examples are that Natalia increased her score by 10 points, Jessica by 10 points, Jose by 21 points, Juan Carlos by 25 points. So those last two students showed 3 years worth of growth in 1 year. Which is incredible, and it's a real testament to having this extended day program, which offers smaller class sizes, more focused instruction on specific skills that students need, and also in a time of increased class sizes. Our 3rd through 5th grade classrooms all had more than 30 students in them last year. So we met AYP despite some of those limitations, and I know our teachers really feel, too, that it's due to having that extended day option for students. Just another thing to highlight is that Sun is a great outlet for our students with disabilities. We have supported behavior classroom in our school for students who cannot maintain in the regular classroom due to behavior difficulties, but they're invited in Sun, and one of the students shared with his teacher that he feels normal during Sun school because he's with his regular classroom peers. And students with special ed education and disabilities in academic cognitive arenas, they can excel in activities that aren't academically involved, so they feel success rather than deficient like they can feel in the regular school day. And one more highlight to give you, I've heard mentioned several times, Sun is wonderful exposure for students with limited English, and we have an increasing number of refugee students at our school. And I'll just give you an example of a little girl from the Congo who arrived in February last year. No prior school experience. She'd been living in a refugee camp with her family, and no English. And the school day was a struggle for her. She had difficulty behaviorally in school with that structure and those demands. But in Sun, she thrived because she was able to make friends and learn social English, and she enjoyed the gardening club and the music classes, which reminded her of her experiences in her homeland. So that was really successful for her, and we see that across the board with our limited English speakers. It's wonderful. So I'll say that last year our Sun School served, as Brooke said, up to 350 of our 600 students during the year, which is wonderful. But at the same time, it's 250 students that weren't served, and we dream of seeing all of our students served in an after-school and Sun School program. So thank you for hearing us today.
Great. Thank you very much. It's so exciting to hear about the good work that's being done, even in a time of deficient resources, and I particularly appreciate your focus on all kids, engaging everyone in all of the activities at your school. Thank you very much. Any final comments from the panel? Thank you all very much. And with that, I will close the informational hearing on the Sun Community School. And
Wow, that was a little loud. open an informational hearing on the Gladstone Center for Children and Families. I'd invite Bob Stewart up. Welcome, Mr. Stewart.
Thank you very much.
And we're running a little behind, so we're probably compressed to about 15 minutes. Do you think that'll work for you?
I think we can make it work.
All right.
I can make it work, yes.
Thanks.
I'm missing the icon to turn into a slideshow. So if you want to hit that, that'd be great. Just turn it into a slideshow. There. Thanks. My name is Bob Stewart, and I'm superintendent of Gladstone School District, and I'm here to talk to you about a project that we've been involved in for about 5 years now. And I have to refer to two different computers here to get my bearings. First of all, just very briefly, my own journey, this is about early childhood. A great deal of this will be about early childhood. A lot of it's about collaboration and partnerships. My own journey on this is that when about 10 years ago, I've been superintendent of the school district for 12 years. About 10 years ago, I attended a session that Governor Kitzhaber was talking about his priorities. And there was obviously a great deal of emphasis around early childhood. And at the time, I thought, you know, a lot of money is going to K through 12, a lot of money is going into early childhood, but there's a disconnect. We don't talk to each other very often. And that didn't seem right. And so I approached our own local commission and asked how I might get involved. I was invited to a meeting with early childhood program providers, and I was a fish out of water because I didn't know what they were talking about. So that started a journey in which we've attempted to connect in our own community. And but this is a little bit about an opportunity that existed, too. Part of this is a presentation we actually did at the National School Board Conference in April. I've mentioned collaboration and partnerships. It's also a story about community revitalization, sustainability, a generosity of one specific donor, an investment in the kids in our community, and a way to do things more effectively and more efficiently than we have been in the past. As far as some reference points, I have a packet of information for you, and just very briefly, let me tell you what you have. There's a booklet that I'll refer to in a little bit that talks about the vision for the center. There's a chronology of events that have occurred, and this is what I'll refer to today as I talk to you about things that have occurred that have brought us to the point where we have a center for early childhood. Some information about the programs that exist is also in the packet, along with operational agreements, and eventually I'll talk to you about some news articles that have occurred. Some other reference points, the Children's Institute is a partner that we have come to know over the last year that are very influential in early childhood efforts. And then there's some articles for the Oregonian and others. The programs that some of which I was aware of, some of which I was not, but things that in some way we have a connection to now. It was kindergarten, Head Start program, early childhood program, which are students with disabilities ages 3 and 4 years old, a blended preschool in which we incorporate kids with their typical kids without disabilities into the early childhood program, Healthy Start of Clackamas County. I'm assuming that you know what a lot of these programs are. If you have a question later on, I'll be glad to answer those questions. The Department of Human Services, mental health, our community college, nutrition programs, our WIC program, play groups that are run through our Healthy Start program involving toddlers and wobblers and their parents, our homeschooled in our community, a community health clinic, our first relief nursery in Clackamas County, community preschool, they reach out, areas that we're reaching out to are our community preschools, our daycare providers, and we have just incorporated an early Head Start classroom into the facility. Okay, so the story.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Really quickly? In listing all of those, the one early childhood program I didn't see in there was early intervention and early childhood.
That's part of the early childhood program that was mentioned there. It's early intervention / early childhood, which is all run through our ESD.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. And my wife is an instructor in that, so I'm very familiar with that program.
Thank you.
The connecting early childhood and kindergarten, this slide It shows a grocery store that is right across the street from Gladstone High School. It opened in 1965 as the Danielson's Thriftway Store. And at one time, the school district actually owned this property. And where our football field is now, we swapped it in the mid-60s with the Danielson family, and this grocery store was built. The it's just a few blocks off of Highway 99. For those of you that may not know where Gladstone is, if you think about the Clackamas and Willamette Rivers and where they meet, Gladstone is just to the north of the Clackamas River. This grocery store was the heart of the community. It was the place where people gathered. If you wanted to get a message out about Gladstone, a school message, you made sure that the people in the grocery store knew what it was, because there was conversation that occurred within the checkout lines that helped us a lot on any issues that we might be facing. The store closed in 2002. Its location and the fact that supermarkets kind of overwhelmed things, the store closed in 2002. It sat vacant for 2 years. It was directly across the street from our high school. It was obviously a concern because it was zoned that absolutely anything could go in there. And we contacted the owners in 2004, the Danielson family, and we began some conversations about the future of that store. We deliberated the merits of the purchase. I initially went to our school board, and I'll never forget this meeting. It was in 2004, probably late spring, and I said at the board meeting that we have the opportunity to maybe look at the possible purchase of the property. What do you think? And I'll never forget, the school board chair looked over the top of his glasses at me and said, "Why in the world would we do that?" And if you're sitting in my position, that's kind of one of those things where the collar gets a little bit tight. But that started a conversation with the school district and the owners. I went through a lot of due diligence about that, and in January 2005, we had a framework for the purchase of the property. Part of that framework was that the Danielson's family donated $800,000 of the purchase price back to the school district, and we bought the 3-plus acres of ground, the facility you see, which is about 35,000 square feet, for $1 million. In the spring, this shows the inside of the building just after we purchased it. You can see where the tile's missing on the floor is where the coolers used to be. You can see all the where the different departments were in the store. And in the spring of that year, as we were closing the deal and as we were thinking about what's the best use and is there a best use, there was a meeting with four people in the facility. It was myself, our special ed director, the director of Head Start from Clackamas County, and the ESD's early childhood intervention, early intervention director. And we sat kind of in the middle of that big room, and with all those murals all around us, and we just said, "What if?" And we started to write some notes. And what if we could turn this into an early childhood center? Is there an interest? Are there other partners that are possibilities? What might that look like? We have a bond measure in May of 2005. We became the poster child for the double majority. We passed the bond with the 62% yes vote, but we failed because we had a 43% voter turnout. Had all of the people in the gap of the 43 to 50% voted no, we still would have passed the bond. So a year and a half later, we went back to the voters, and we passed it was $40 million then because of inflation, but we passed a bond measure at that time for the facility. And not just for the facility, it was for many things in our school district. That was just one of the things. After a lot of study as to what we would use this facility for, we narrowed it down to one finalist. And the one finalist was, we were overcrowded at our elementary school. We could continue to add on an overbuilt building, or we could look at doing something different. What we decided to do different was move kindergarten out and move into this facility, and invited lots of partners to the table to discuss the possibility of joining us in that. Okay, just a little bit about Gladstone.
I just wanted to remind you of the time constraints. We're about 10 minutes into the 15.
Okay. I'll wrap it up fast.
All right,
okay.
Thanks.
Gladstone is a community of 11,000, district enrollment 2,000, and our per capita household income in Gladstone is less than the statewide average. We've had a change in our demographic. Our free and reduced population has increased by a lot. First year I was superintendent, you can see what the lines were in 1999-2000 and what they are now. This is not unusual for suburbs of Portland. This is happening all over the metropolitan area. I expect our free and reduced population in our elementary school to be around 60% this year. The vision, Gemstone Art Community, the foundation for all future learning, designed especially for young children, support families of young children, and a collaborative model that enhances our services. This is the layout of the facility. On the right side, you would find kindergarten classrooms. On the upper left-hand corner, all of the Healthy Start staff of Clackamas County is housed there. Up in the upper left-hand corner, the early childhood program for the ESD. In the classrooms on the left, this is in the gray area. On the left side is where Head Start is located. And on the far left side is the Gladstone Health Clinic, which opened 2 weeks ago. It will serve 4,000 to 5,000 people out of that clinic. And right now it's focusing on pediatric care. And in the blue area will be the future home of the Family Stepping Stones Relief Nursery, first relief nursery in Clackamas County. And they're currently being housed in a church basement in Gladstone. In total numbers of people involved, kids involved, there's about 140 kids in the kindergarten program. All are housed there. About 80 kids in Head Start. All are housed there. About 30 in the ESD's early childhood program, which includes an autism classroom and a regional autism classroom. And then numerous kids that arrive in many other programs. So, kind of the summary of it is that we now have partnerships and formal partnerships with the following programs that all exist within the programs, other than the ones I've mentioned. WIC is there on two days a week, handing out vouchers and doing well baby checks. The Clackamas Community College offers evening Spanish-speaking GED programs. The DHS is there at special functions to hand out information about self-sufficiency. We have a full-time mental health worker through LifeWorks Northwest and our own Clackamas County Health Department. And, of course, the health clinic is a major plus for our community because it is such a positive thing to happen where all of our kids, the thing about it now is that all of our kids in Gladstone, regardless of their economic condition, have access to health care. And that never happened before. And so anyway, it's a very rewarding and positive experience to have this. The future is that we are sending some people back to the Harvard Institute in about 2 weeks on pre-K through third grade. I believe what we'll wind up with is an integrated curriculum from third grade on down through early Head Start that will set a new benchmark for our third grade children that will be at the what we would call the exceeds level of academic achievement for third graders, which we know if we can get kids to that level, that their likelihood of maintaining that and maintaining to meet benchmark all the way through high school is very probable. And but by interweaving and combining a curriculum that can go all the way down through third grade and have it be or through 3 years of age and have it be consistent all the way up will produce that kind of a positive result.
And is your early childhood special ed program part of that benchmarking continuous curriculum?
Yes. As a matter of fact, when we return, the conversation that will occur will be between our Head Start program and our ESD primarily and our own staff within our K through 12 program.
Thank you. Questions?
Just praise.
Yeah. Very good.
I know the speaker is very proud to be in the community and suggested that we hear about this program and has been really excited to talk about the successes. But
well, we're very proud of him, too. It's the center has become a community center. Most of the politicians in the area have used it as a town hall place for at one time or another. It seems to diffuse people when they come in, and I think that's a good thing.
That's a good thing.
There is a video because of time, because it lasts about 7 minutes, but it can give you an overview of why all the programs think it's important to be there. We probably won't show it now, but it is on our website, and you can do a quick click and be able to access it that way.
And I can forward. Thank you. Great, thank you. And Cheyenne is saying she can forward that link to each of us as well to make it easy to access that video. I didn't look this way when I said, does anybody
have any
questions?
Well, just a real quick question. I came in late. I recognize. Is this the old Danielson Thriftway?
It is.
Okay, thank you. I used to do a lot of bicycle runs there for my mom. So.
It is the old Danielson Thriftway.
Are you sure? Yeah. I just want to say, several of us actually heard about this last year through the Human Services Committee, and it's great now to hear it from the perspective of education because it's just such a perfect partnership of those sectors.
What I can tell you, if I could just take a minute just to, because I didn't talk about the effectiveness and the efficiencies. There's a real economic reason to do this, too. By the partnerships, we've been able to blend programs. And for the school district, we're opening a 35,000-square-foot facility that we own. And it costs us about $25,000 a year of additional resources over and above what we were spending before. And if we were doing this at another location, it would cost somewhere between $500,000 and $750,000 if we were doing it alone, of our own resources. And so there's a on the efficiency piece, it's very real. On the effectiveness piece, I can tell you that because we're together, as a superintendent of the school district, I knew that our early childhood program, these are students with disabilities that are 3 and 4 years of age, that frequently school districts move in and out of schools based on space. And I knew that if we can get them together with our kindergarten program, we can make that transition a better transition from 4 years of age to 5 years of age and not have that break in the service and trying to refigure out what works for the kid.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're
certainly
welcome.
Very exciting things
yeah,
are happening.
Thanks.
Can I,
Representative Conley?
Sorry, I just have to mention this because a good friend of mine, who became a good friend of mine to Dulles, Olson, and Weeks, this is the playground I wanted as a principal. We had it designed a long time ago, but we didn't get the funding.
It's a good playground.
It's a great playground.
One of the first events that occurred there was a prominent family in our community. This is an evening event. Held their 50th anniversary at that site and had all their family come in, and they took their family portrait in that playground.
Yep.
Thanks. Well, thank you very, very much.
Thanks for the time.
Colleagues, we've been sitting for a while. Would people like to do a 5-minute break before we go into our last chunk? I've seen lots of head nodding. Okay, so five
we're
minutes.
We're going to whole time.
Well, okay. Let's call it 7. So let's come back at 3:15.
How much? 3:17.
Let's just call it even. 3:15.
Yeah. All right.
So we are in a recess.
Today's still Tuesday.
And the House Committee on Education will come back to order. It's still September 21st, and we are down to two of our last items. And the next two items are melding together a little bit. I want to give a little bit of an introduction. Then we're going to hear directly from some folks at Medford School District and Southern Oregon ESD. We're going to hear from some families in the school district. And at the end of all of that, we're going to have a joint panel of Southern Oregon ESD, Medford School District, and a parent advocate from the community to answer any questions that we might have after hearing all of the testimony together. But I wanted to give you a brief introduction as to why the South Medford issue is on the agenda and why it's not, and a couple of the issues that it is intended to kind of inform our discussion on. So we'll hear more from folks, but essentially there was an issue in South Medford High School where a great thing happened. The community made a really significant investment in new capital construction in the district, and they were able to make very substantial improvements to many of the buildings in their schools, including building the first new high school in that region for quite a long time, maybe 30 years. It's been a very long time. And right before school started, as the students of South Medford High School were getting ready to go and register at South Medford High School, it became clear that there had been a lack of understanding about what was going to happen to certain students at South Medford High School who participated in special education. And they learned at that point that rather than moving with their classmates to South Medford High School, they would be staying behind in the old building that was being replaced with a new alternative school that was being built there. And that's created some energy and controversy in the community about what that was like, what that experience is like for those students no longer going to school with their high school kids. These are not issues that we can resolve as a legislature. However, they highlight a couple of other issues that we started to hear about in this committee during our last session. We've heard from families in like Oswego, Portland, Beaverton, all over the state, Gresham Barlow, about challenges that families sometimes have accessing services for their kids, accessing programs in their schools, and what kind of voice families are able to have in planning for their education services. We also have been having many conversations about ESD reform. And one of the issues we hear a lot when we start talking about ESD reforms is the role of ESDs in providing services to special education. And we frequently hear that without ESDs, we wouldn't be able to provide services to students with disabilities. So this particular issue really kind of casts in stark relief something that gets repeated across the state, which is the parents' ability to participate in decision-making, be informed of decision-making, and understand what happens, and also our understanding of what is the appropriate role of an ESD in the delivery of services. So that's kind of the frame that this is in. It is in no way intended to pick on any particular school district or ESD. It's just that as we're moving towards February, this is where we're able to look to kind of see these two issues outlined in really bright contrast to be able to talk about them with some specifics, because oftentimes these tend to be pretty esoteric kinds of issues. So we're going to start with kind of the story of South Medford High and the STEPS program with some information of the folks there, and then we'll have a different panel of people following after that to move towards legislation that we are considering next session that has to do with the who bears the burden of proof that students are receiving appropriate services when there is a dispute in special education services. And so with that, and if I get this wrong, let me know. We've got, and just to highlight who's in the room, because people have traveled a long way to be here, we've got Nancy Hungerford, who is an attorney for the Medford School District, Tanya Tong, who is the Supervisor of Student Services for the Medford School District, Scott Perry, who is the ESD superintendent, Bruce Zagar, who is an attorney for Southern Oregon ESD, Kelly Knorr, who is also an attorney for the school districts, and Sandra Cruz for Southern Oregon ESD, the director of special education. And some places there's a star that you're speaking, but then it says a no. So if you're speaking, will you come up and introduce yourself so I don't bring the wrong people up. So I'm assuming Scott and Tanya. And Ms. Cruz, are you coming up as well? And Mr. Perry?
Do you want both ESD and the district, or do you want the districts to start?
I thought you could all come up together as an opening panel, since, and then we'll move to the other panel of the families, and then we'll bring back Scott and Tanya and Emily. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Tanya Tong, and I'm Supervisor for Student Services for the Medford School District, and I would just like to thank Chair Gelser and committee members of the House Education Committee for this opportunity to provide information to you regarding this situation. And as you know, with me today is Nancy Hungerford, and she is the attorney for the Medford School District. I would also like to say that our superintendent, Philip Long, was not able to be here, although he would like to have been here, but he is actually celebrating the dedication of the North Medford High School today. So I've been asked to be present today to answer questions that have arisen about the siting of special education programs in the Medford School District. Changes in the location of some programs have occurred as the result of the support of our citizens in passing of a $189 million bond measure to substantially renovate and upgrade all of the schools in the district. This has made it possible to provide improved facilities for all of our programs, both regular and special education, and we would like to thank the Medford community for their support. The Medford School District is one of nine districts in Jackson County, and our district serves approximately 40% of the county public school students. Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA, directs the process for the selection of a placement for all special education students. And with me being the supervisor for our special education program, I'm intimately familiar with that process. The IEP team includes the parents and the student, if possible, as well as teachers and specialists, such as speech-language pathologists, physical therapists, and occupational therapists. The IEP team is responsible for developing an individualized education program to meet the child's unique needs for specially designed instruction and related services. Additionally, the IEP team also identifies any needed accommodations, modifications, or supplementary aids and services. Once the IEP has been developed, the next task is to identify a placement. And a placement is not a physical location, but a set of characteristics of service or a program which the IEP can be implemented. This must be the least restrictive placement in which the student's IEP can be implemented. As required by the IDEA, the Medford School District provides for the availability of a continuum of placement options. We have programs that serve students with high incidence disabilities and are generally not needing a self-contained classroom, and are able to participate in the regular classroom for the majority of the day, such as speech, language, and educational resource services. And we have those programs located in every school in the district, and all of those programs are operated by the Medford School District. Additionally, we have programs serving students with low incidence disabilities who have more specialized needs and sometimes are run by the district, and sometimes we contract those services out through Southern Oregon Education District. I would say that many of the ESD programs are actually located on site in our schools. Students from all parts of the district or from the region, other regions in the county, are grouped in these programs at a central site. This allows for a delivery of program and services that are more economical, but also a program that is more attuned to the special needs of the participating students. In the particular classroom in question, there are a total of 9 students. 6 of those students are Medford residents, and 3 of those students are from 2 other school districts. The ESD's provision of some of these specialized classrooms make them available to smaller districts, which do not have enough students to maintain such a program on their own. Additionally, the STEPS programs provide highly specialized services to students with severe to profound disabilities. And the Medford School District accesses these services when our district-operated programs cannot meet the needs of our students. This pattern of centralizing specialized programs is used at all grade levels, not just the high school, in order to efficiently and effectively address the varied needs of students who are eligible under IDEA. With the availability of renovated facilities, the Medford School District has been able to locate specialized special education programs for greater accessibility and efficiencies. Specialized special education programs are located at all three of our high schools. We have an Academy of Essential Skills, which is a self-contained program, and a STEPS program, which is also a self-contained program. Both are located at North Medford High School, and we also have a FOCUS program, which is a self-contained program for students with severe social and emotional needs that is also located at South. At Central Medford High School, the STEPS program shares the focus of the school on community service learning for all attending regular education students. And it should be noted that Central Medford High School is a different school setting than in previous years. Previously, this school was associated with three other alternative education programs, although not at the same location. Those three programs are now part of Medford Opportunity School and are not affiliated with the new Central Medford High School. At each high school, students in the specialized special education programs, aka self-contained program, have the opportunity for inclusion with non-disabled peers when the IEP team determines that is appropriate. Also, under IDEA, the guarantee is that the child must be educated in the least restrictive environment, which generally means contact with non-disabled peers. There is no guarantee that such contact will be with typical peers. In fact, we don't look at students as typical or atypical. Central Medford High's total student enrollment as of last week was 205 students and is not based on academic or behavioral difficulty, but the students' ability to benefit from the smaller size and more direct contact with a few teachers. While regular education students and their parents may be the ones who generally select Central Medford High School, the district may also assign some students to Central Medford because of the appropriateness of the program to meet the students' needs. Central Medford is still finishing renovations, but does have a library, cafeteria, accessible restrooms, including one adjacent to the STEPS classroom, with staff trained to provide necessary assistance. Central Medford High School does enroll regular education students who receive instruction in all the basic subjects and electives necessary to obtain a regular diploma. So there is no lesser access to the regular education program than at North Medford High School or South Medford High School. Students in the STEPS program are working towards an alternative certificate, and I will say that is primarily for students in the Medford School District. I can't speak for the other school districts. That decision is made in concert with the IEP team. The inclusion of STEPS in a community-based school, plus a centralized location in proximity to businesses, make possible experiences such as job shadowing that will greatly benefit students enrolled in the STEPS program as they prepare for their post-high school years. The Medford School District has utilized guidance from the Oregon Department of Education in its decisions about centralizing and locating special education programs. The district makes it possible to meet the very specialized needs of its IDEA-eligible students in a cost-effective manner. Since questions have arisen about the location of the STEPS program at Central Medford High School, we have committed to hold new IEP meetings this fall, bringing parents, staff, and students together to relook at the STEPS program and whether it is appropriate for each individual student. Thank you.
Thank you. And just quickly, how many Medford students are served in the ESD STEPS program?
K-12.
And not just at Central, but district.
We have 85.
85.
Out of approximately 1,236 eligible students.
And so for those 85 students, you contract with the ESD, who then hires a full-time teacher to teach Medford students in your Medford school buildings.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
And is there a reason why the school district could not directly hire those same teachers to teach the same kids in the same classroom without the overhead cost that goes with purchasing those services through the ESD?
Sure. We actually do operate our own self-contained programs for students with probably moderate disabilities, but we have probably 200 to 250 students, in that particular, category as far as the type of support they need. And because we have less students who are severely to profoundly disabled, we actually cluster our resources together. So it actually is more cost advantageous for, say, Phoenix Talent and Ashland and Medford to join our funds together to actually support the classroom. So we actually, rather than us paying for, a full teacher for them, so to speak, it's a cost per student.
And just as a follow-up, I know in my school district we have some self-contained classrooms and districts that are around. Corvallis is bigger, and our ESD doesn't have special classrooms. We keep all of our kids, we assume that all Corvallis special ed kids belong to the Corvallis school district. And other districts come in and do interagency agreements to use those same things and aren't going through the ESD in order to avoid those additional costs. If you didn't do that, might you be able to plow that savings into additional occupational therapists, speech therapists, EAs, direct services to kids instead of to ESD?
Yeah, I don't think so, and we actually do have our own occupational therapists. I think for the students where we need to contract the ESD services specifically for classrooms, their needs are so unique that we don't have specialized staff to do that. So, for example, if a student is nonverbal, we may have, say, 5 students in our entire district, K-12, that may be nonverbal and may need to learn, say, sign language. We don't have trained staff to meet the needs of those students. So by actually clustering the services, we feel that ESD offering those services via a classroom setting has been extremely valuable to the students we serve.
And I think I didn't ask the question very clearly. My question was more about maybe that classroom teacher or the classroom support. So you might have a class of, you know, 12 kids in Medford, or you said you had 85 kids that are Medford kids served in Medford schools by the ESD, kind of the FTE that make up that. Why aren't those contracted directly by Medford and then bringing in the ESD to supplement those highly specialized low incidence pieces that...
Sure. Well, I think if we take the classroom in question at Central Medford High School, there are 9 students in the classroom, and we have contracted 6 spaces for that. It would not necessarily be cost effective for us to have a classroom of just 6 students.
And for the other 80 kids?
Well, that's K-12. So depending on every year, you know, depending on what grade level students are in, we may not have a nice cluster of third grade students where we would, you know, have 12 students in a classroom. And I would say a long time ago, we used to have K-6 self-contained programs, and we have definitely moved away from that because that, I guess, might speak to what you're referring to of having, you know, a classroom, there's the students' attendance areas are kind of all over the district, and say we have 15 students in grades kindergarten through 6th grade who need that level of support. But what we found is this, because the range of their needs were so different, as well as their age, it did not allow us to develop a high-quality program. So we now actually have programs where, although they're cross-graded, it might be kindergarten through 2nd grade or 3rd grade through 6th grade, so we can better adapt our instruction to not only the needs but also the age ranges of the students.
Are there other questions for Ms. Tong? Representative Comp.
I have a phobia against acronyms, and I don't begin to wonder what STEPS means. But could you give me the determination number if there are 90, 60, or 70, what their IEP determination is?
As far as what the disability category is?
Yes.
I would say all of our programs are non-categorical, so students are not placed in a particular program based
on their... In the STEPS program, are those students in a self-contained, at an identified 60 IQ level that they need support?
Okay, so I want to just clarify, make sure I understand your question. Is your question, are students in the STEPS classroom, do they have cognitive scores that indicate they have intellectual disabilities?
Yes, that's what their IEP. And when you're talking about 85 students, I would really like to know how many of them are at 90, 70, or 60.
Okay, and I could say that because they're non-categorical, we have students that have autism spectrum disorder. There are students in there that are qualified under the category of mental retardation, other health impaired, okay, multiple disabilities.
We're on two different pages.
Follow-up?
Yeah, well, the follow-up is I've only been out of the principal's chair for 6 years, and I didn't know the federal government changed identification standards, but maybe I'm wrong.
Could you clarify the
Again,
question?
Again, we looked at their assessments were a part of their identification for an IEP, whether they were in the resource room or if they were in a self-contained classroom where they have much greater one-on-one support. I'm looking for the breakdown And particularly, if you, when we're looking at space that's needed, you're looking at going across your city boundaries. You're looking at the needs of the students, which I really appreciate, because that's what we're supposed to do. And yet, I haven't heard you say how many students meet this need. I hear that you have 85 students that, to my understanding, possibly are identified as an IEP, on IEPs in Medford, but I don't know if that's what you mean. Okay. I have a real definition breakdown
here. Okay, I appreciate that clarification. Maybe I can answer the question better.
Okay.
Okay. I would say that all students who are in our self-contained special education classrooms, whether it's a STEPS classroom, and I don't know what that acronym means, or if they are
I have no idea.
Yeah, or if they're in a program called Academy of Essential Skills, that's another self-contained program that our district operates at the high school level. I think the important terminology is probably self-contained classroom, and I actually did bring our 2009-2010 SPR&I, but I'm going to tell you what that acronym stands
Thank
for.
Thank you.
Yep. Systems Performance Review and Improvement Data, and that actually is data that we work with the Department of Education. It's a new federal mandate.
Right,
to
federal
have indicated.
Mandate, right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So for 2009 and 2010, the Medford School District had 10.7% of our total special education population removed from the regular classroom, 60% or more of their day. So that, you know, is another way to say a student may need a self-contained classroom. So it was a total of 132 students.
Representative Roebling?
I want to do a clarification because
Thank you, because I still haven't gotten an answer to my question.
So just let me go. You have approximately 1,800 kids with IEPs. Is that what you said earlier?
We last year had approximately 1,236.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And of those, there are how many that are in self-contained?
132.
And of those, 85 of them are served by 85 of that 100 some are served by the ESD in programs K through 12.
Correct.
Okay. So the group that we're talking about with the STEP program at Central contains 9 kids, of which 6 are yours.
Correct.
Because you have 6 seats.
Yep.
The other 3 are available to outlying districts.
Correct.
And they are students with multiple handicaps.
Correct.
Generally. Including health impaired as well as cognitive disabilities.
Correct.
So that's the 9 that we're talking about that are at Central. You have another program that you can of self-contained kids at South and another one at North.
Correct.
One called STEP and one called your other alternatives program.
Yeah. AES, Academy of Essential Skills.
Thank you. Does that clarify?
That helps.
Okay. So the group that are at Central, which is the one that is concerned, are 6 kids from
Medford. From Medford. Correct.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to.
Thanks for helping me there.
And could you, I guess the one last question I'd have before we went to Mr. Perry, how would you describe the basic differences in terms of the social opportunities, access to quality of facility, theater programs, team programs, graduation opportunities, breadth of elective opportunities between Central and South where the kids were moved from? When were the students notified? Can seniors stay at Central? And the last one would be, and I'd sent this in my email, when I looked up Central High School on the ODE information, it listed it as having a 4% graduation rate and being on one of the red-listed lists of schools. And I wondered what would happen if AYP isn't met for these STEP students next year in terms of the access to transportation and voluntary transfer to another school within the district and tutoring.
Okay. I would say Central Medford High School this year has provisional accreditation as far as a comprehensive high school, and they offer a full range of basic classes and elective classes so students can work towards a standard diploma. So I'd say the coursework is very similar to South Medford High School. There are electives, music classes, art classes, theater classes. There's also a variety of project-based and service learning classes. In regards to the red list and AYP, my understanding is that that applies only to Title I schools, and none of our high schools are Title I schools, although we do have 7 schools at the elementary level that are Title I. So any of the sanctions you refer to would not impact any of our high schools. And in regards to the 4% graduation rate, I think I would refer back to my earlier comment that prior to this year, Central Medford High School was actually called Medford Opportunity School, and there were three other alternative programs related to that school, and I would say that I think that's where probably some of the misconceptions about Central Medford High School and the community have come from. There were three alternative programs. One program was for students who were expelled. One program was an assessment and evaluation center for students with mental health needs, and the other was OnTrack, alcohol and drug recovery. And I think maybe what the community is not aware of is last year, those programs were at a completely different location from the regular campus of Medford Opportunity High School, and now the regular campus has now been renamed Central Medford High School, is at a different location, and those different programs are not really affiliated with each other anymore.
Thank you.
Yep.
And then finally, that last question I didn't hear, when were the parents and families and kids notified that they would not be going back to South Medford, and what happens to the kids that were seniors this year in terms of graduating with their class of peers?
Okay. I can speak to the second question, and
okay.
I think the first question I'll let ESD respond to that.
Sure.
Okay. We are meeting, and I will speak only for Medford residents. We're meeting with each of the students and parents to reconvene the IEP meetings, and one thing we're looking at is what types of diploma options the students are working towards, and also what types of integration they had prior to the classroom remaining at Central Medford High School. So individual decisions will be made, and if a student is working towards an alternative certificate, we feel confident that we can continue to provide that type of support through the ESD program that's located at Central Medford High School. If a student will be working towards a different type of diploma option, since the Medford School District has standard, modified, and extended diploma options available at another site, we probably would look at relocating them to one of our district-operated programs. And then also, if a student was integrated into a class, we would work with parents to see if they wanted to go to South for that particular opportunity, and if it's an opportunity that can't be provided at Central.
Thank you. Mr. Perry.
Slide down here. Chair Gelser, members of the Education Committee, thank you for inviting me to speak today. I'm here joined by joining me is Sandra Cruz, who is the Director of Special Education for Southern Oregon ESD. Southern Oregon ESD provides a range of services to children and families. We serve Josephine, Jackson, and Klamath counties, a region about 10,600 square miles. It's the largest geographical region for an ESD in the state of Oregon, providing services to 13 school districts, approximately 50,000 students in total. And our the law that really dictates what we do, how we do it, is Oregon Revised Statute 334.175. And that designates service areas for us to be in the area of administrative and business services, special education, and technology, and school improvement. In addition, that statute also talks about the goals of our service, and those goals include enable component school districts and students who attend school in those districts to have equitable access to resources, so serving an equity function, and also maximize operational and fiscal efficiencies for component school districts. In accordance with that law, we also have a process whereby we go to our districts each year and we develop a local service plan. Our districts weigh in terms of what they want the ESD to be providing, and their school boards have to approve that local service plan. The rule is that two-thirds of our component school district boards need to approve it, representing over 50% of the schools that we serve. So that's how we develop the services that we offer. is through that process of including the school districts in a conversation. I have been superintendent for a little over a year at Southern Oregon ESD. Prior to that, I was at Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD, and I have been very impressed and proud of the services that are offered by this ESD. The services are to a great extent very appreciated by the districts and by the families of the children that are directly served. We provide a variety of supports in technology, really do a lot of the technology infrastructure for the region. We provide a lot of school improvement, teacher staff development, and administrator professional development. We oversee the migrant ELL programs and the career and technical education programs in our region. But the largest portion of our service is in the area of special education. We have early intervention, early childhood special education programs in Josephine County. We provide we have the contract with the state to provide regional services to children with a variety of special education needs, such as vision impairment, hearing impairment, autism, and orthopedic impairment. And then we also have the program that we've been talking about, which is the STEPS program, and I can tell you what that stands for. That stands for Specialized Training and Educational Program Services. The name came out many years ago, and really most people, even at the ESD, no longer know what it stands for. But they've really shortened it to STEPS, Educating for Independence. And that's kind of the theme that is used when we talk about the STEPS program. We have 22 STEPS classrooms in our region, serving approximately 240 students. To enable us to provide these students with a range of learning experiences with non-disabled peers, we work with our local school districts to place these classrooms in schools so that those classrooms are part of a school's culture and a school community. Our local school districts provide the classroom space at no charge, and the ESD provides the teachers, the education assistants, the materials, and essentially the education program. We also provide specialized support to students in the classrooms, such as occupational and physical therapy, autism consultation, school psychologist services, the services of a school nurse, specialized feeding and swallowing intervention, etc. These are highly specialized services. Providing them on a regional basis makes really good sense, we think, because we have an economy of scale, a larger group that can provide specialized services as they're needed. Placement of a student in an ESD-operated STEPS classroom occurs only after the student's IEP team, including the parents, has concluded that the nature or severity of a child's disability is such that education in regular classes and or other less restrictive settings with the use of supplementary aids and services cannot be achieved satisfactorily. As has been pointed out, these are regional classrooms, so one classroom may have students from several different districts attending because we're looking at developing a regionalized efficiency in providing these classrooms. And decisions, again, about the location of the STEPS classrooms in a particular school district are typically made by that district in consultation with the ESD. And from time to time, classroom locations are changed, especially during the summer, based on shifting enrollment patterns in districts as well as the enrollment patterns of our STEPS students. One such change that led to controversy in our communities, the one that we've been talking about, and that is the decision to locate one high school STEPS classroom at the newly remodeled Central Medford High School building. Last June, the Medford School District met with me and with Director Sandra Cruz and shared a proposal to locate the classroom there. And the advantages and disadvantages of that location were discussed in that meeting. A major focus of the meeting was on how student individualized education programs, the IEP, needs would be met. They called for them to be educated with peers who did not have educational disabilities. At that time, Medford provided strong assurance that those needs could be met very well through interaction with the over 180 students. Actually, it's now 205 students at the new Central Medford High School. At that meeting in June, we also developed a plan for communicating with parents about the location of the classroom and some of the elements of the classroom. And so unfortunate assumptions about that communication occurred to the point that the communication did not happen until August. And that was very unfortunate. And the ESD assumes responsibility for the lateness of that communication. And it created, and I understand how that created, very significant confusion and frustration on the part of parents who thought that their children were going to be going to this new South Medford High School and finding out that the children are going to be going to Central Medford High School. A great deal of frustration has been expressed to me, and I have apologized for that communication. As a result of that, Medford and the ESD leadership have determined to reconvene each student's IEP to look closely at student present level of performance, needs, goals, objectives, and associated placement, as well as review with parents Oregon law and parent options related to the diploma, the modified diploma, the extended diploma, and alternative certificate. As per federal law, each IEP is already reviewed annually with parents as part of that process. The IEP can be reviewed more frequently if questions arise, and thus we're convening those because we want to make sure that we are addressing each individual student's needs as per the IEP. In inviting me to present testimony today, Chair Gelser indicated a desire that my testimony address four questions, and I'd like to repeat those questions and provide some response to those. Number one, how does this reflect on the role of ESDs in special education and the relationship to ESD reform? The relationship of this situation to ESD reform is unclear. There are voices that are calling for changes to Oregon's ESD system, and there are actually a number of different proposals that are floating about. There's no clear indication, at least to me, as to what the nature of those changes may be. We currently provide regional services that are prioritized by the districts we serve through that local service plan process. And those are provided in those four areas. And I think that we do a good job of listening to districts, adapting our services, being transparent about our finances, and providing services in special education, technology, school improvement, and administrative and business services. Federal law requires school districts provide a continuum of services for students with special needs, and the Southern Oregon ESD STEPS program is part of that continuum that districts have asked us to provide. Second question, how does this reflect on our ongoing discussions about appropriate dispute resolution in special education in Oregon, particularly as it relates to the ability for parents to have their voice heard in decisions about their children? Federal law spells out means through which disputes are resolved in special education matters, and a key element of the law ensuring parent voice is the individualized education program process. This is the process that we're using to address current concerns regarding the STEPS classroom in Medford, and it's been our experience that that IEP teams, which include parent participation, have been successful in developing plans and placements that are appropriate for students. The third question, how this reflects on the implementation of modified and extended diploma legislation. Central Medford High School is able to provide access to coursework and classes necessary for students to obtain a high school diploma and a modified diploma. We're developing means for providing an extended diploma, and we are also able to provide an alternative certificate. How does this reflect on the ability of parents across the state to access comprehensive education services in the least restrictive environment? Parents, not only across the state, but across the nation, are given the legal right for their children to have access to comprehensive programs in the least restrictive environment. This is determined by the IEP team. It's important to note that the IEP team consists of parents, teachers, specialists, administrators, and other persons deemed important to the child's education by either educators or parents, and the ESD may be part of these teams. Having a background in special education and having been working with special needs students for almost 30 years, it's my passion to serve these children. And as I work with the individuals at Southern Oregon ESD, teachers, education assistants, it is their passion as well to provide appropriate and quality services. And it's really not often that we have a parent frustration expressed like this. There is a great deal of satisfaction with the programs that are provided by Southern Oregon ESD. In a continuing effort to assist with information from other ESDs, if this committee would like it, I would be happy to collaborate and collect information from other ESDs who provide direct instructional services to students. This morning I did some research, and there are about half of the ESDs, 10 out of the 20 ESDs, that provide direct instruction, self-contained classroom instruction to students with severe needs. And I could provide you a list if that would be helpful. Sandra, are there elements that I have?
Thank you. And I'd ask you to summarize a little bit. We're, our agenda item was 45 minutes, and we're 45 minutes to our first panel. Sure. Great.
You can hand the microphone over.
Well, I'd like to take a stab at answering Chair Gelser's question about why wouldn't Medford just hire that teacher on their own, and not speaking for Medford, but having been affiliated with the STEPS program for about 14 years, I would tell you that it's not just the autism consultant and the feeding and swallowing specialist and so forth who are specialized, but the teacher is also very specialized in terms of training, experience, and so forth, as are the educational assistants. And perhaps even maybe more importantly, the supervisors of that program.
Oh, Ms. Cruz, could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. I'm Sandra Cruz, Director of Special Education Services with Southern Oregon ESD. So in addition to the teacher, educational assistants, the supervisors of that program have background in the disabilities and the needs of children who are served by the STEPS program, and that's something that districts can't readily replicate. I also want to let you know that every single year we look at the cost of the program, and I can guarantee you that Medford or any other school district would not be sending students to this program and asking us for services if they didn't feel they were cost-effective. And probably every 3, 4, 5 years we really sit down shoulder to shoulder and roll up our sleeves, and the district brings in their numbers and say, boy, if I were running this program, this is how I would do it, and this is what it would cost to me. And the answer has come up again and again. We can't do it as cost-effectively as the ESD.
Thank you very much. And with that, I am going to move on to the next panel in case, unless people have burning questions right at this moment. Thank you all very much. So our next panel, we'll have you back in a minute. Emily Sampson, Dolores Rubino, and Juliana Faulkner, please. Welcome, and as you've heard before and seen earlier today, if you could start by sharing your name for the record. And I would also like to welcome Representative Peter Buckley, who has come into the room, and I just so appreciate his work on all of these issues, and thank you for taking the time to come down and listen, Representative Buckley.
Please. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to share with you about special education system from the perspective of families. For the record, my name is Emily Sampson, and I'm from Medford, Oregon. I represent a group called Families for Community that have actually been birthed from this issue, and it contains families and self-advocates and just community members who feel passionately about what is happening and what we see, how we want children included all over the community. I have the pleasure of being the mom to three boys. Andrew is 10, Brennan is 8, and Parker is 5. Our youngest son, Parker, experiences autism. I have many fundamental reasons why I believe that placing the STEPS classroom at Central Medford High School campus is not an appropriate placement. I think a key factor in the upset of parents, students, and community members is the feeling of being left behind. We all want to feel like we're a part of a community. As children, their community is obviously their school. It's where they attend with peers to learn academics, to learn how the world works socially, and to have fun. Much of a child's identity is based on where they go to school. I know my 8-year-old son Brennan is very proud to be a Lone Pine Wildcat. And during the construction of the new South Medford High School campus, teachers and staff, including the STEPS teachers, were consulted on what they would like or need in their classrooms on the new campus. So imagine the surprise of parents when they're only told a few weeks prior to school starting that they are not being included on this campus. Many times we as parents feel that our children who experience disabilities are not welcome as easily as our non-disabled children, and to many families, this felt like you're building a new school and we're not welcome. I think much of the upset of parents comes from that. Parents also agreed that to STEPS placement would be appropriate for their children during the 2010-2011 school year based on the assumption that it would be in a traditional comprehensive high school as it had always been before. On a traditional high school campus, such as South Medford High School, opportunities for inclusion and to educate our children in the least restrictive environment abound. Opportunity to participate in things like Spirit Week, go to prom, go to lunch, make new friends are much more simple. But on a self-contained campus such as Central Medford High School, these kids won't have the same opportunities to access their non-disabled peers. While STEPS may be a self-contained class, housing it at a self-contained school isolates these children even more. Oregon was a pioneer state, being the first state in the Union to close down all institutions, large and small, that housed adults and children who experienced disabilities. By leaving this class of 9 students at the old campus, it really felt to parents like we were taking a step backwards. Another frustration of parents is how information is not readily accessible to them. It is a shame that information did not go out to families when the decision was originally made in June. Well, the name of the STEPS program has not changed. The character of the placement, in my opinion, is completely different. And why was this decision due to its location on the non-traditional high school campus? And why was this decision made, A, without the input of parents, or why were parents not given the option to immediately, at that point, reconvene an IEP process? If placing these students away from the high school setting is what parents would want, then I can see that. My question is how are parents assessing information in regards to opportunities and rights for their children? And in this case, many parents didn't even know who to ask. They didn't know, is this something we talk to Medford School District about? Do we talk to the ESD? Who can answer our questions? As a parent, I always want to believe that my son's IEP team is truly that, a team, working together to give Parker the supports necessary for success. When decisions of this magnitude are made without the involvement of parents, we're left to feel as if it is not a true team. We're left to feel like our perspective was not taken into account. And I know everyone in this room would agree that us as parents are the experts on our children. And in order for parents to trust the education of their children to a team, they must feel like they're valued and included members of that team. Collaboration between families and the rest of the IEP team is important and imperative for a positive income. My hope for the future is that there's constant communication and collaboration between all on the IEP team. This year, the students at South Medford High School are missing an important part of their student body. It does a disservice to our non-disabled kids to not allow them the opportunity to create school relationships with those kids from the STEPS program. The best way to help children overcome their misconceptions about kids who have disabilities is to bring them together in integrated settings, to pass them in the halls, to have inclusion in your sports teams, and in every aspect of school. I have provided for you, each members of the committee, letters written from 3 former South Medford High School students. Unsolicited by me, these men wrote letters about how their lives were changed forever by a young man in high school named Eric who experiences autism. Their relationship with Eric made them the men they are today. I always say that my older boys, Andrew and Brennan, are going to be better men because they have Parker for a brother. Some lessons in school you can't learn from books, and that you can only learn from relationships. Thank you.
Thank you. Juliana. Oh, do you want to go in the other order? I'm sorry.
I think you wanted her to be last.
Sure.
Right?
She great?
Yes, please. She was ready to follow me, and it was just like, ah.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dolores Rubino, and I'm a mom, and I live in Jacksonville, which is within the Medford School District. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to come and share my story. I'm coming at this from a different perspective. I am the mother of an engaging young man, Noah, who is 18 and has Down syndrome. In this last year, he also got the educational eligibility of autism spectrum disorder. Noah just finished up the STEPS program in June. And my perspective is from looking back and from also my perspective, a disturbing pattern of lack of inclusion, which culminated in what happened in June, and I will share that with you. Noah attended school in the STEPS classrooms from September of 2000 when I moved to Jacksonville until this past June. From the very beginning and at every IEP meeting, I brought up my desire to have Noah spend increasing amounts of time with non-disabled peers. And although I would say that his teachers, the speech therapists, the instructional assistants were caring, skilled, loving women with whom I built relationships and have relationships today, I have to say that at my IEP meetings with Noah, I never really felt that my hopes and my desires for Noah were truly embraced by members of the IEP team. It always felt like there was something that I didn't get or something that I didn't understand. And I just want to drop in here. I also am a special educator, and I do IFSP meetings all the time, and so I have this weird thing of sitting on both sides of the table. And even with that, I would go to my son's IEP meetings and get discombobulated and feel weird and not totally supported in my belief of Noah's potential. And that was an ongoing theme for me through his entire school experience. There was always much talk regarding behaviors and how to deal with Noah, but not much talk about how to teach him to read. He does not read. How to teach him to write. He still does not write his name. How to teach him simple math, or how to provide for him more opportunities to participate with typical peers. An example of this was in his STEPS classroom at Kennedy School. This was early on in my experience, and I was pushing as hard as I could, and the teacher was trying to see about getting him into a reading group in one of the classrooms. And I remember two things that were said to me. It was tried very briefly. He had a hard time, and two things were said to me. One was that the general ed teacher, you know, it was really hard because he was disruptive. The other piece was, you know, it takes a staff person to go to that classroom with him, and, you know, it was a problem. So, okay, I walked away from that. I had a full-time job and a career and other kids at home, and I just didn't have the energy to fight every single thing, and I confess that was my fault. But this pattern continued throughout his STEPS experience, culminating in the graduation issue, which I confronted in June. Toward the end of May, I stopped by his classroom and was greeted by his teacher, whom I love to pieces. I was given an invitation to a graduation celebration for Noah and two peers, which would take place in the STEPS classroom on a weekday. I was very confused by this and said, and it wasn't like this is a party. This is a little graduation announcement that she had made, which I thought was very sweet, but I didn't understand. And I said, what is this? And she informed me that the STEPS kids did not walk at graduation, and that was historically true, and that they hadn't, except for 2009, and that was because she went to bat. She had two girls who were very excited about graduation, very hooked in, and really wanted to walk with their class, and she went to bat, and those two girls walked. Prior to my knowledge, and I've had three other kids graduate from South, and I've been to those ceremonies, there were not STEPS kids included in the graduation ceremony. So, needless to say, I was a little upset, more than a little upset, and I immediately set about to write a letter to complain. I wrote a letter. I delivered that letter to Mr. Campbell's office, the principal of South Medford High School, also to Hal Jones, I think, vice principal. I'm thinking. And then I also gave the letter to one Medford school board member with whom I had relationship. Within 24 hours, I had a phone call from Hal Jones assuring me that, of course they want the kids to walk, of course. Like, and it was very strange because he was behaving as if this came out of left field. I was upset because I said, my child's been in the Medford School District all these years. You don't know who my kid is? He's a Medford School District kid. He made it sound like it's up to the STEP staff to let them know when they have graduating seniors. And I wasn't buying it because I knew there'd been a history of kids not walking. And so this gets to the communication piece that's been brought up here. I don't know what was going on there, but it felt icky to me, and it didn't feel good. The bottom line of that was that a very few accommodations were made, and these three boys were given the ability to walk. And I want to tell you what happened. These three boys, we were at the very end of the ceremony. Oh, let me preface it by saying at the rehearsal, we did the walkthrough, and then we left. And then the kids, the seniors, went through it again. And I was told that Mr. Campbell announced to the seniors who were there that, and these were the words that were said to me, what he said to the seniors was, for the first time, our STEPS kids are going to walk. And the senior class erupted in spontaneous applause. That was significant to me. That meant a lot to me personally. Well, at the actual graduation ceremony, it was even bigger than that. When we got up to walk, each of the parents was responsible to escort their senior, you know, give them whatever help they needed, which was fine. The entire place, all of Spiegelberg Stadium, all of the seniors, everyone stood up, screamed, yelled, cheered. It was probably the most moving experience of my life. And I felt like it spoke volumes about the beauty of inclusion, the beauty of acceptance, and what we need to be working toward. I know it was just the graduation ceremony, but for me, it was way bigger than that. And my son was totally enjoying the moment, totally knew what was going on. I wish I would have brought his pictures, smiling, walking down. He was a happy camper. And everybody in the place was happy. People had tears in their eyes, and I'm not exaggerating. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm looking for. That's what I want for these
kids.
And
I apologize. I have to ask you to summarize because we're running out of time.
I'm sorry, I'm done.
All right.
The burning question to me is why... why have the STEP students been excluded from this rite of passage? Why did I have to complain in order for this to happen? And the larger concern to me as I look back over the years that Noah was in STEPS and at the current decisions that are being made by Medford and Southern Oregon ESD is, in my mind, a disturbing pattern of exclusion rather than inclusion. And I see this as an issue that needs to be addressed by a change in thinking and a resetting of priorities by leaders in our educational community. And I'm sorry I went over, and thank you so much for your patience.
Thank you. And the good news is about the graduation issue. In 2007, and Representative Buckley was the chair of the Education Committee at that time, we passed a law that guarantees and says every student in Oregon that earns a modified standard, a modified diploma, a standard diploma, or an alternative certificate must be allowed to walk and included in a high school graduation ceremony. And that has been the law since July 1st of 2007.
It has. And I actually got those OARs. I had them in my hand in case I needed them. Actually, they're still in my car. But they flipped pretty quick, and it happened. It's just a shame that I had to even be an issue at all, is my point.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you.
Oh, okay.
And Juliana, if you can start by stating your name, that would be very helpful.
Well, that's in the beginning what I'm going to say.
Okay. Very good.
Hi, my name is Juliana Faulkner. I began my education in kindergarten at Palace Park Elementary School in Park City, Utah. From the very beginning, I went to the regular school classes and I made many friends. There were times when Miss Wessel came and helped me with my reading and math. And sometimes my friends would help me too. I continued through middle school and there were always wonderful teacher's aides to help me. Mary Clark was one of them. She would help me understand some of the lessons the teachers gave. In high school, I took many dance classes. I loved to dance. I made up my own dancing routines and performed in school productions. After 4 years of high school, I graduated with my class at Park City High School in 2004. All through school, I made lots of friends, and I learned a lot. When I found out that some kids in Medford are being left behind at the old school, I felt really sad. It's not fair that all the kids don't get to be together and learn from each other. I learned so much from my friends. They taught me that I had the same opportunities as they did. Today, I'm 25 years old. I live with my mom and stepdad, and I work at Old Navy. I work out a lot at the YMCA. Can you tell? And I'm thinking of taking a dance class at Rogue Community College. I also fly all by myself to visit my dad in Park City, Utah. I can even figure out the airport shuttle. Now I want to tell you about my friend for life, Brandy. We became friends after when we were in elementary school together, because we have been best friends forever. Brandy has decided to go to college and to be the first in her family to go. She will be graduating next spring. And guess what? She is going to be a special ed teacher because of me. Please let the kids go to school together, and everyone will learn that being together brings out in then out the best in people, like my friend Brandy. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Thank you all so much for coming and taking the drive up. Are there any questions for this panel before we move on to the next one? Representative Kamp.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. It's just a brief one. I was just wondering, our first presenter here, I forgot your name. I apologize.
Emily.
Mm-hmm. You said you didn't know who to reach out to, whether to reach out to your school district or to your ESD. Had you thought about contacting your own attorney about your child's rights?
I have not. I know my son is educated in the STAR program, and I know that he is a Medford School District kid. I know that there are at least two families within the STEPS program this year that have contacted attorneys.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I guess any other questions? No, I would have a follow-up. We have some attorneys in the room. Did you have any attorneys today that were available to you to help you prepare your testimony on this issue?
No. We just
thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think we're going to move into, because we're running short on time, into the next item. And then if we have time at the end, we'll bring everybody back up together so we can get everybody in. I've lost my piece of paper. I think we have Catherine White, Jim Wrigley, and Roberta Dunn.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities, and I have to apologize. As soon as I give my testimony, I'm going to leave to catch a bus to Eugene, which is my commuter bus. So, I wanted to speak just very, very briefly in support of a discussion on legislation that may be coming before this committee on the burden of proof. And I wanted to just kind of attach that discussion a little bit to the previous conversations that you have had related to Medford. The Individuals with Disabilities Act, which you heard something about, and I know this committee is very familiar with, has to be considered in the context of civil rights legislation. It is no less than civil rights legislation. It was passed because of a historic disenfranchisement of people with disabilities. It is intended to entitle kids with disabilities access to public education. And the law clearly defines parental participation as a part of that process. And it's defined in the law as school districts are the ones that can determine the free and appropriate education. School districts are the ones that make the decisions on these issues. Parents are clearly a part of that decision-making process. There is also safeguards within that law to provide other processes for families. The council that I work for receives frequent stories describing situations where families continue to confront that access to the free and appropriate education and the implementations of those individualized education plans. Some of these examples include things like the failure to provide transition services, failure to provide necessary related services, and placements, for example, made on categorical decisions. We see in this example from Medford, from what our experience has been, is that students' educational placement was changed, their educational experience was changed dramatically without the input of the families. And in order to kind of go back to what their previous experience was, they are going to have to engage in a lengthy legal process. Currently, the burden of proof rests with families in situations where they are challenging the free and appropriate education that has been decided, rests with the families in situations where they are challenging the school's decisions. And this is an example where the burden of proof would lie and rest with the families. Families are at a significant disadvantage in these kind of situations. They lack access to attorneys. They lack access to the materials, the information. Schools have a paper trail. They have greater resources than families. And so for families, it's a significant barrier to challenge educational placements and educational decisions. In fact, organizations like Disability Rights Oregon are one of the few places that families can turn to for assistance in these circumstances. We believe that it is fully appropriate to change that burden of proof, to place the burden of proof on the districts so that when there is a challenge, that the districts need to prove why they support that particular educational placement. I think that the overlay of the ESDs has created an additional challenge for many, many families, and I think you heard it here in the expectation that the ESD would notify the families rather than Medford School District would notify the families. My son was served through an ESD program for many years, and it took me years to realize that really the ESD was the contractor and that the legal responsibility for my son's services continued to rest with that local school district. We were caught between the two with the two pointing fingers at each other's. I think that that ESD situation simply is an overlay on top of what what is a very confusing and disempowering situation for families. And that is why we would support the change in the requirement in terms of the burden of proof. And Jim, you can address questions.
Are there questions for Ms. White?
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. You know, it's interesting, we didn't get a chance I'm assuming an opinion from the Hungerford Law Firm regarding Medford School District addresses this very issue, and it's very what Catherine was saying. I think the crux of the issue is that this analysis assumes that you have two equal powers, and that in fact even remotely suggest that there's an equal power structure here is really disingenuous. I understand what the Supreme Court said. I think that's probably what it said. But the point is that the power structures are not equal, not even close to being equal.
Thank you.
And I think that's really the crux of the issue. I'm not sure how we ever get to an equal power structure, assuming that the funnel of money or the spigot of money is not worthless.
Thank you, Representative Maurer. And I think that that's one of the recommendations. There are other states who have changed the burden of proof, and we believe that that does a greater job of equalizing some of those issues.
No, Paul. I just think it's a very interesting issue to that. I'll be here. Yeah.
We'll miss you. Thank you. And please, are there other questions for Ms. White before she dashes to catch her bus? Thank you very
Thank you
much.
Very much.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jim Wrigley. I'm an attorney with. My name is Jim Wrigley. I'm an attorney with Disability Rights Oregon, which represents people with disabilities. We're a federally funded agency. I'm going to talk briefly about the burden of proof issues that have been raised here. We think it's very important that the burden of proof be shifted to school districts for some of the reasons that were just mentioned, that in fact there is a serious power imbalance between parents and school districts, and the system works better if there are ways to actually balance that power. And some of the issues that came up in the Medford situation really have to do with communication, who has information, and these are things that basically parents often are left in the cold, where they really don't have access to the same level of information, the same amount of voice, the ability to be heard in situations, and then they face a very daunting task, really. No parent rushes into a due process hearing, or very few, because they face a very daunting process of having to basically expend, unless they're lucky enough to get services from an organization like mine, which doesn't charge, they have to go out and find a private attorney at considerable expense. They have to themselves pay for experts to make their case, and they recognize they have to completely upend their lives for months. And the due process hearings themselves are incredibly complex and cumbersome and long proceedings. So what we're really dealing with here is a situation where parents don't reach for due process hearings as a favored tactic. And it's very important, though, that they feel that they have some chance in a due process hearing, and that there be as much as possible that we equalize the power, as was spoken about. And one way to do that is to restore the burden of proof to that burden, restore it to school districts so that they have to prove that they are, in fact, providing an appropriate education at the beginning of the hearing. And that seems very reasonable to us that makes sense, basically, that the school districts say, yes, here's the reasons why we're providing an appropriate education, and the burden be on them by clear and convincing evidence to do that. So we would strongly support a bill that would, as has happened in other states, restore the burden of proof back to school districts. And then briefly, we would also concur in the comments about the ESD, that ESDs may play a valuable role, but the fact of the matter is that, as we've heard today, there are some puzzling overlays and confusion that are built into the ESD system right now, and we would strongly advocate again for people to look at it and figure out how can ESDs really be helpful to children and families, and to the extent, and be efficient, and to the extent they can't be, that it's worth taking a very close look and saying, well, how can we change the system so that we're getting the best education for families at the at families and children at the most affordable price? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Another comment to that.
Chris Miller.
What I think we've done is boxed in the school system, the other side of the table of this conversation, by the myriad of laws and regulations that really have created an environment of adversary between the parent and, quote, the system. Because you have teachers out there, obviously, that care deeply about these kids and establish a relationship over time. But yet, the people that are trying to administer this program, their hands are tied. Their hands are tied by a bureaucratic system that, unfortunately, we and our peers above us, federal level, and the courts have created because of, you know, every time there's a problem, we create a legal fix. And so, you know, how do we turn the clock back, not to an old time where we seclude them, but to a new time that, in fact, allows some flexibility, some common sense to prevail in these conversations. Because a lot of this is, quite frankly, is about common sense. And, you know, and the district probably wouldn't object to much of this if we just untied their hands.
And I would add to that, I think one, the most compelling comments that I've gotten on this issue over the last several years have actually been from teachers and direct service providers who feel that they cannot provide, they just feel ethically bound by not being able to provide information to families about their children, about what they need, about how they are progressing, because they have to answer to those who must administer the programs who are anticipating this whole issue of burden, and therefore the information gets held back. We would probably have a lot less conflict if all information about a child could be brought to the table and teachers were free to discuss what kids needed, occupational therapists, speech therapists were free to talk about those things, and our current system really creates a disincentive for that to happen.
Well, because of the threat of a lawsuit. I mean, and that's where it lies, is it's a litigious environment, and when you feel threatened, you know, one wrong move, and there's going to be a lawsuit, and it's usually not the parent that instigates it, but it's some other outside organization that funds it. And that's where the districts feel threatened.
I think districts feel threatened. I think families feel threatened. There was a keynote that was given by a special ed attorney for a district this summer, and she talked about how she liked to push things to the courts, partly because people give up and partly because you get precedence that way. And I think that would be an interesting analysis to look at: who is most often pushing things to that court level? Is it the families, or is it the school districts that have access to the attorneys? And if we could mediate these things at a lower level, we'd be serving kids. And I think ultimately it's not about who's right, it's how do we get kids educated. And with 42% of Oregon kids on IEPs never getting a diploma of any kind in Oregon, we've got to find a way to get educational services to these kids and stop focusing on dispute resolution as often.
And I heard a comment, and not this conversation, but another comment. It was, well, we are trying to get the interest to agree. And nowhere in that conversation was, well, what's best for the kids? And when, you know, we need to be able to drop down that special interest, you know, curtain and actually answer the question, what's best for the kids?
Representative Van
Roven. Thank you, Chair Gelser. Well, I don't think you can dismiss the fear of the burden of cost either. I do think that drives some of the conversation. And it, again, it's, you know, and the other issue is funding. You know, we're asked to do this, but the money didn't follow from the feds.
And I think we then also have to, obviously I have an opinion on this, but we also have to look at how our resources are spent. And I think we can see an example of that today in this room, where you have families that are here, and I assume that attorneys that are here are not here for free, but are funded through public dollars. And are those dollars... their education dollars. Where are we balancing these things when we talk about lack of funds?
I think we still have Ms. Dunn.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Roberta Dunn, and I'm from Beaverton, Oregon, and it is my pleasure to share with you today. I did submit written testimony that's succinct and I would say more thorough, and I did attach along with it something called the Fact Family and Community Together Education Issues, and that I will allow for you to read on your own time, and I, just acknowledging the hour of the day, will just kind of jump into some of my perspective here. I am the executive director of an organization, Fact, Family, and Community Together, and we're a statewide group dedicated to empowering Oregon families experiencing disability. I come sharing the results of our forum on education as one thing, but I also come today as a parent. I have three wonderful young men. One's a senior finishing at the University of Oregon, one is a senior at Southridge High School, and one is a junior at Southridge High School. My junior's just been invited to join the National Honor Society, sings in the men's choir, is attending or is currently working on an essay on street law for one of his courses, and happens to be a young man that experiences Down syndrome. He's been fully included in the Beaverton School District since we moved here, though that has been a challenge. I my mind just races as I listen to the families and to Juliana share, and I think of my young son, and I remember attending his very first IEP meeting. He was 4 years old, and I arrived having just gone to a conference and feeling very grounded in the best practices of educating a young person with developmental disability, only to be told, but no, we don't include kids with Down syndrome. We have a program for them, for the mentally retarded, for the severe and profound, they referred to my son. And it was only because of the fact that I'd been able to be grounded in the best practices of inclusive education that I was able to stand to that and say, I'm sorry, we're going to have to work together as a team because that's just simply not going to do. And that was a long time ago, but that doesn't stop. When we first moved to Oregon, my son having been included kindergarten through the fourth grade, we arrived at Meet the Teacher Day only to have the principal call me into the office and say, well, we're sorry your son's name isn't on any teacher's roll. We thought you just hadn't heard about our programs. And I thought, well, gee, we had faxed his IEP to you, and you were perfectly aware that he'd been included in an inclusive setting for all of these years. What would make you think we would change that now? He was making progress, as is in the spirit and intent of IDEA, making progress toward goals with the necessary supports within the general education classroom with access to his peers. My concern with the conversation that we're having today and my excitement that you're having it is the idea that for so many families, they don't arrive at that first IEP grounded. They arrive, I believe the prior speaker shared, discombobulated, and I believe that would sum it up. And so when someone proposes that the only placement, the most appropriate placement, is their placement and has something in mind, then my concern is that immediately a child has been channeled at the age of five to a destination, a trajectory that is going to take them somewhere. But I think five is a little bit premature to determine the worth and the value and the future contributions of any citizen, including someone like my son. My son right now is preparing to graduate and has every expectation to attend college. I don't think the IEP team thought that when he was five. I think that it's really important that we make sure that the team is not arriving with predetermined notions about the caliber, worth, and qualifications of their young people. Often I hear from families that they arrived and that someone, based on diagnosis or eligibility code alone, has predetermined placement with sayings like this. And, of course, politely I acknowledge that it's never said that predetermination has taken place, but when a statement like, our mobility room is where we'd send your son, Well, that sounds like predetermination to me. Or when we say the MR classroom, that sounds a lot like predetermination to me. And I think that when we talk about the ESD programs, a lot of young people, and this is where my heart comes from, they're young people that experience Down syndrome and other intellectual and developmental disabilities. And that MR eligibility, sometimes in districts just due to their program model, it off-ramps them right away, and they never see the light of day. And my concern with that predetermination is also that there is no reentry plan. And in your conversations regarding ESD reform and whatnot, I would really hope that there would also be a conversation about when we do identify the need to utilize ESD programs, what is the plan to reintegrate that young person into their local community school. If the ultimate goal is that at 21, a young person arrives prepared to be employed and to live as independent as possible in their community, how can we off-ramp them at 5 into a program that takes them out of their community, that only causes them to experience others experiencing similar levels of disability, removes the opportunity for them to build community.
I have to ask you to summarize, please.
So,
I'm sorry.
Well, and so in general, those would be my concerns. Now, at the very heart of what Jim and Catherine had shared prior to me, the burden of proof. When a family comes, they don't come with the wherewithal and the understanding that the district has. And so when someone is quickly told no, the family doesn't even fully understand that they have even legal recourse. We may be given that pamphlet with our rights a dozen times. That does not mean that we have the wherewithal and the personal understanding to be able to see that through. And I guess what I would just like to close with, what I'd just like to close with is a concern of mine, and that's that college-educated, middle-income, frankly, white families should not be the only ones able to access an inclusive placement. And right now, because it takes such great means in order to make that happen, we are ending up isolating and further segregating a group of people who just simply do not have the wherewithal to stay connected to their local school. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your time. Thank you, committee.
Thank you very much. Are there any quick questions for this panel? Great. Thank you all very much. We are now 15 minutes past the time we're going to end the hearing, so I think we're not going to have time to do another panel. We've got one more quick agenda item. Is the committee okay with that plan? All right. So I'm going to close the informational hearing on South Medford High School STEPS program and burden of proof, and open an informational meeting on committee bills. And this is just an item. Are there bills that we need to be requesting as a committee? Are people working on bills? We can always introduce them as committee bills once you've had them drafted. Representative Maurer, you look ready to speak.
Well, yes, because I haven't asked this to be drafted yet personally, but it's this issue of spell check on the state writing assessment. You know, it'd be horrible to have to write a law to say, let's not use spell check, or put a time period to say timeout. But, you know, and I'm disappointed we didn't have an opportunity to talk about that today, and because I think it's a travesty that we are doing that. SAT doesn't. I know that NAEP test does, but frankly, colleges don't look at your NAEP score. They look at your SAT score. And SAT does not let you use that as an accommodation, and I don't know why the state of Oregon needs to do that. So I think that needs to be revisited, and if we need to have a timeout on spell check, like we have a timeout on online learning, then that's the bill we ought to introduce, and it should be a bipartisan. I have yet to talk to a teacher, to a parent, to a student that says, you know what, that's a great idea. And the only accommodation is people will go, well, you know, maybe there are people that have a special need that need that as an accommodation, which is completely a different issue. But to make that the standard for all students is, quite frankly, unacceptable.
So I did have a conversation with Representative Springer. The agenda and the request to add it to the agenda kind of crossed paths in the email box late last week, so we are adding that to the agenda for December, so we'll have an opportunity to have that discussion at more length. In the meantime...
Good luck on that, by the way.
The discussion? You'll still be here in December, so
if you
can't laugh at us yet.
Sure you can.
So would you like to work on drafting whatever you want to draft to bring it to that committee hearing, knowing that that's a potential to introduce as a committee bill? Do you want to spend time here hammering out what we would want to have drafted?
We can talk about that later. I don't know if it's appropriate me to do that, since I won't, and I would not want to tie the hands of my successor, whoever that is.
Okay. Well, I think the one thing that's important to this discussion generally is that next Monday is the deadline for House members to request bills that will get back in time for pre-session filing. So if it is something you have an interest to and you have the ability to make that request, even though you won't be coming back to us.
Yeah,
and
I may talk
others.
To other members who might want
okay,
to
great.
Deal with that.
Thank you. And are there things that we should be hashing out today or other requests for the December agenda?
Yes, Chair Gelser. There's several of us that have been working on ESD.
Yes.
And I think, there's the potential that we'll want to do something here from the House perspective about governance.
Okay.
So if we could have a review or update or
for December?
Something that would, so that everybody could be part of the discussion.
Right. And I trust that your group is working on getting LCs drafted.
Yep. We're just goofing off, but we'll do it.
All right.
Yes, we will.
You're a taskmaster. It's hard for me to imagine your committee's goofing off.
Well, I asked you. I want a playground and all this other stuff.
Yeah, I
like a little fun in life.
All right. Anything else for the good of the order on committee drafting bills or requests for December? And you can, of course, continue to email those requests for the December agenda until that November. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to back up a little bit, I'm not going to beat a dead horse, but we were talking about the spell check. And I do hope, first of all, I hope it doesn't take a bill to address that issue. And I do hope that the Superintendent of Education can be here in December and talk about where that decision came from, why that decision was made, and then in a more thoughtful, planful way, maybe we can move forward to address that.
Great. Anything else? All right. Thank you all very much. Thanks for everyone that made, many of you made very long drives today. Thank you very much. And the House Committee on Education is adjourned.